occur to have prevented members being here at 9.
I introduce my colleagues, the Cape Town office, Michelle Lasson, and then, of course, I come from Johannesburg, and excuse me, that's where our head office is. I was going to show a short video, which was, and I might still, if I may. It really just encapsulates the spirit of Africa, and this is what we've been working on, and we find as a motivational means of motivation.
Get rid of this. And it's important. came to, which led to brothers, and which led to a group concerned in God's state. I never seen a hell place before. I never felt in a hotel. So, on the same birthday in Arusha, my English was, I said something like, I tried and I let it. So I would like to say something to all the people out there, like me, to the Africans and the poor, who are struggling with your dreams. God bless. Maybe one day you watch this on the internet. I say to you, trust yourself and believe. Whatever happens, don't give up. Thank you.
The purpose of Shane Hatch is really to establish the base from which we come as an organisation, and it's about the spirit of Africa that's going to take us forward. So we welcome the introduction of the second phase of the RPAP document, and really commit ourselves to its purpose. Just a bit about our organisation. Our purpose, and we're mandated by our benefactors, to grow the consumption of stainless steel products converted in South Africa. We have around 500 members, and within the 500 members there, in the region of about 35,000 employees, directly or indirectly involved with stainless steel. We have 11 staff members. We are certified at level 2 BBE, at triple BEE. We're based in Johannesburg, Cape Town and Durban, and we were established in 1964. Stainless steel is a bit of a mystery to lots of people, and essentially what the message is, that it reflects hygiene, strength, long life, quality, beauty, and it is also a green product, it's recyclable, which in itself says quite a lot. SASA's key areas of activities are centered around enterprise development, communication, and lobbying. Just to give you some perspective of the stainless steel industry from a global point of view, one can see on the bar graph, just what stainless steel production is worldwide. That's the big column. You can see where South Africa's production capacity is, and actual burn that's shown on the red block, and our consumption. So you can see quite simply that we have a place on the global map, albeit not that important or that great. It's certainly there, and not many countries have got that. Privilege to be playing in this market. The picture of the South African scene is a little bit more interesting, in that we have local production capacity of 700,000 tonnes of stainless steel on an annual basis. We produced for export and for local consumption 500,000 tonnes in 2007. A little less, 480,000 tonnes in 2008, and around the same 480,000 tonnes in 2009. Of that, you can see the bulk has been exported, which leaves a local sales value, which is shown down on the, and it shouldn't be in that colour, but on that white bar, has been in the region of about 100,000 tonnes a year. Which the question that begs answering is how much capacity there is available for South African producers to use. Now, it's about downstream beneficiation, obviously, and it's about creating those opportunities to use that material that is produced. The facts of the market are that there are components that are, or not components, at least product that is imported in its raw form, both of a special nature, but also of a standard nature, in other words, what our local manufacturer produces. But opportunities exist. This is what our performance has been over the last couple of years, going back to 1991. But it's no surprise that we see this massive drop-off in the 2008-2009 year. And that has had a severe effect on the business. We've seen a drop of in the region of about 35 to 40% in offtake. When you start looking at what we import, and, And this is where we see ourselves launching our industry from. We import significant amounts of finished product, as shown in the red block. The blue block is the primary product that's imported. The scale on the left is measured in tons, and you can see it by year. The question that we keep asking ourselves is why we import finished products. And it's an area that is of great concern to us. The reasons are abundant, and we put a plan together and a program together to deal with this, which I'll get to a little later. This will show you just some detail on last year's imported tonnage versus 2008, and you can see the trend of 2009 showing upward in a downturn market, which in itself is disturbing, and downward in an up market, although that's not factual towards the end of 2008. It's factual, but it's of interest. The four areas that we import products, two of them are industries that we have available and we have the capacity and capability in this country. Hollowware and tableware, knives and forks, teaspoons and other such things, make up the bulk of the imports into this country, and I will be able to show you some more detail on that just a little bit further. Kitchen sinks make up a fair portion, as represented by the colour red, and tube and pipe and fittings in the green. Now, the tube and pipe and fittings, there is an element of no production capacity here or capability, but we still nevertheless import, and it doesn't mean we can't develop that capacity. And you can see that other finished products in stainless steel make up quite a small portion of our total import. I'm going to skip that, but that's about what we export in terms of finished products. Although it's stacked up high, it's not terribly high in terms of value, outside of the tank and the automotive market. Just some facts relating to the hollowware industry. In 2004, 43% of the consumption in South Africa was manufactured locally. 57% was imported. In 2005, 82% was imported and 18% manufactured locally. 2006, 80 and 20. 2007, 72 and 28. And in 2008, 71 and 29. Now, remember that volumes increased quite dramatically over this period in terms of consumption. The 2009 figures are available, and I had a meeting with one of the major producers of pots and pans just the other day, and he believes that only 5% of that market is being serviced out of the South African producers, which I think we think is very disturbing, but besides that, we see it as being a big opportunity because we have the capability and capacity to revive that industry immediately, literally immediately. Our goal in this process, and also in answer to the IFAP document, is to grow sustainable employment. We understand that has been the key, and we see certain opportunities which we could fill those gaps and meet that goal. We also understand the need to alleviate poverty. However, we also need to understand that we need to find and develop areas of manufacturing excellence. The issues facing our industry hinge around the following point. Imports. We have low-cost, low-quality and imports coming into the country, and besides that, we also have a lot of tariff manipulation. I'll give you an indication that of the cookware that comes into this country, a large quantity comes in from Malawi, Zambia and Mozambique, all of which do not have a pot manufacturer. Which begs the question, obviously needs to be answered. There's no tariff applied to it, so we have tariff manipulation, and they've just basically packaged in this country and moved over the border as a product of that country. From a safety and health point of view, we have some, once again, very serious issues. They're all centered around the quality of product that comes in, as well as I use the word contaminated imports, but that I probably would need to just enhance on that a bit. The threat of products arriving in this country and having been radiated with nuclear material or been contaminated with nuclear material is a possibility. The reason this happens is that material is neither inspected on at departure point or inspected for radiation on arrival, which puts the country at severe risk. And an example that you could use is if you were buying a cheese grater that was made of Chernobyl waste product, I'm sure you wouldn't be too happy. Now, it's the fact that it's happened in Italy, and it's the fact that it's happened in Germany. Not necessarily Chernobyl, I use that as an exaggerated term to bring the attention of the members to this issue. However, we do have some solutions and we are working on those. So really just to highlight the issue more than anything else, I showed that slide or showed that. We have a skills problem, retaining skills within the industry and also the development of skills. And lastly, there are some manufacturing challenges. They center around the capital, the supply of skills, but also some inadequate technology. We have works and producers in this country that really haven't grown in terms of the technology. We produce in fits and spurts, and there are a host of small SMMEs and slightly bigger businesses than that don't meet the need in terms of technology. They are not technologically advanced enough to produce effectively and certainly from a cost point of view, not effectively. Just some of the solutions that we have embarked on. We look to accreditating all those local manufacturers. We would like to instill a campaign of Buy South Africa. We need to educate our consumers. We need to provide protection for our consumers. We need to establish standards. And we certainly want to assist SARS insofar as monitoring the product coming in. In the Safe Can Help area, we're looking to ensure that these standards are in place, and we're working with the national regulator on that in that instance right now. And we need to once again assist, and if we can, with the fleeting of the imported product. From a skills point of view, we see ourselves as being neutral, and we look to forge these relationships with organized labor and business. We provide a risk-free environment to get these minds to meet, and we believe that it would be really purposeful if we could get together and work on common interests. We work with the academic institutions or educational institutions to ensure that the industry needs them, and we provide enterprise development assistance. We have a department centered purely on enterprise development. We look into identifying opportunities in manufacturing, and we hopefully can facilitate a meeting of the minds as soon as we possibly can. Our industry initiatives in response to EPAP are as follows. The first one is that we have started a group looking at craft at various crafts. In simple terms, we're looking at stainless steel jewelry as being an opportunity for the creation of employment. And when we talk about jewelry, we talk about it not in the form of the finite stuff like watch straps, we talk about artwork. And I'll say the simple meaning that the volume side of it. Interestingly enough, we're looking at roughly 4 to 6 people being employed per kilogram of stainless steel used in this industry, and that's right through the value chain. And a kilogram of stainless steel is not a lot of stainless steel. We've started an initiative with Stellenbosch University, Cape Peninsula University. We're working with the Middelburg Steel Incubator, and we're looking at developing a value chain from start to finish. Cost of material in this instance is really minute. The labor opportunity is immense. So all in all, we see this as a really serious opportunity. We've worked with the county government as well, as well as that of the Western Cape. Soda water has taken on a new dimension for us. The concept behind our drive is we've put a group together, we've hosted one major conference, and that happened 2 weeks ago, in which we had 97 participants. The whole idea behind it is to promote the use of stainless steel for long life and hygiene. Our concept is that we would look to centrally manufacture components distributed to the regions for local assembly and installation, so we can create smaller businesses where these products are most required. The reason for manufacture is... Am I done?
Yes, no, what I want you to do, myself have just been through the document. If you could, in the last literally 5 minutes now, begin to focus perhaps on some of the serious challenges which you are facing here, and which you believe through EPUB and the government's initiative we can begin to address in some way.
Could I just finish with start with key elements. Public procurement we see as an absolute need to be enforced, and that is local spend is important, and I know things are being done about that. Locking out unsafe or poor products, we see that as being critical, so these are the challenges. The development of the Party South African campaign we welcome. The development of SMMEs goes without saying, and the need to bind the provincial and local requirements for the momentum. Duplication of work. Just on the hurdle side, we find the difficult challenge is changing mindset. It's where do we go from here? And the talk is over, so we've moved into a new dimension. However, we need to get South Africa to become a little bit more patriotic, I think, and certainly look towards the support of local business. But at the same time as that business has got to come to the party in terms of producing a quality product that is cost effective. We have an issue with small business owners, and I'm not talking about the very small business owners, I'm talking about those that are medium-sized businesses, where they are in private hands, which is fine, however, there's a lack of capital available to them, and in some instances, the mindset is set on the short term and not on the long term. And I think that we need to find ways to work with government to entice these organisations into bringing about a change in their psyche. Corruption is an issue, and it's one that's on the tongues of most. How we avoid it, I don't know, but we need to. And I think there's a need for industry bodies like ours to be actively participative in this process. National, regional, local cohesion. We've seen on numerous occasions in the past with projects that we've launched, this inability to talk to each other. So we will move in one direction with one province, another direction with national government, and even at local level, at municipal level, there seems to be a lack of cohesion. And I would suggest that that's a major problem in its own right. I think I've mentioned the thoughts, Chair, and that's it.
Just before we ask our questions, can you just expand on the corruption? I mean, that's a very general statement you've made.
Sure. Tender allocation, I think, is the major issue. And we would like to see some methodology in place where those who are capable manufacturers of secondary product having the opportunity, and because of their accreditation, so in other words, accreditation high to the award, and that should enable the tender to be adjudicated properly. I'm talking about public tenders, but I just wanted to bring one point to the attention of the members. An example that we use are the stainless steel chairs in your wonderful new airport in Cape Town. Fantastic as it is, those stainless steel chairs were all manufactured in Germany. There's absolutely no need for that. A brewery was built very recently in Gauteng, and that brewery was imported from China when we had full capacity to produce at least 80% of it. Those are the things that we need to avoid in this country. And if you look at what our opportunity is, and if you have time to study it, and we can give you figures if you need to, the amount of imported products that come into this country is extremely high. We need to be able to use that. So if that answers your question.
Well, it does to some extent. I'm going to hand over now to the members to raise their questions and make a few comments. And yes, we would like those figures in a matrix form, please. So I'd like people to really get substantive in their questions, please, and brief. Honourable Ambrosini, Honourable Turok, Honourable Maria, Honourable Tumalo, Honourable Mabasa. Whenever I get M's and K's together, I go blank. My apologies. So we'll start off with Honourable Ambrosini.
Just on housekeeping matter, we asked for the parliamentary registry. We got the ANC study group registry, which I understand to be very confidential. No, if just that. You would have warned me there, probably. Madam Chair, I'm sorry. We are here discussing. This should be the seminal moment, the creative moment of a future industrial base for South Africa. When we discuss the new subsoles, the new Mossgrass, the new Translink, which will take us in the next 30 years. And I have a difficulty, and I don't have the expertise in getting around my difficulty. I have a company which manufactures in Vietnam, in Hanoi, Vietnam, in a factory called Tan Long. They have a great deal of steel coming from South Africa, from Middelburg, and it's all stainless steel. It leaves South Africa, gets there. The size of the factory is about twice the size of this parliamentary complex. They've got presses which are there working three shifts, 24 hours a day, 365 days a week. And they produce the hollowware that we're discussing here for the global market. That hollowware comes back to South Africa. And the price cannot be beaten. So we are faced with the alternative here of either buying something which is more expensive or buying imports. What the Vietnamese government did, faced with the same issue, they admittedly in an environment in which there were no WTO constraints at the beginning, but they capitalized all these industries. And they allowed them to grow, and they kept them going for 10 years, and now they are the manufacturer for the world. The question is, in looking at your industry, what do you think the government should do? Is there a chance of doing a path of development which is similar? Could we compete? Can we expand it into a world competitor, taking advantage of the fact that the steel comes from it?
You want more questions?
We like to take the bank of questions, because some of them do overlap there and there. Honourable Turok?
Yes, I have 4 points, quickly. We'd like some evidence on comparative cost. When there are imports which should not be, clearly one does want to be assured that the comparative cost is fair. Second one is the DTI supportive of this process? It's clearly a very important issue you raised for this committee, and if you can give us some indication of what the DTI does in order to overcome the problem. Thirdly, can you tell us something about economies of scale in the industry? You talk about small entrepreneurs who are not very effective, etc., etc. Are there major issues of economies of scale? In other words, does that wipe out the small person? Because one would like to see small entrepreneurs all over the place as with plastics. Plastics can be manufactured in very, very small scale. Is it also true of your industry? And finally, on the question of procurement and tenders, you know, this is the flavor of the month issue in the press. And it seems to me it's not enough for you to complain. You must tell us whether you think we should push for new legislation to counter this tender entrepreneur business that people are talking about. Because we need answers, and it's not enough to complain about corruption. So it is up to industry to say to Parliament that there is a problem, and Parliament must play its role, and please tell us what you think that role should be. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honourable Marin.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to start off by also saying that there's a lot of things in this report that is very good. I would also like to see, similar to Honourable Turok, then more substance in terms of your proposals and suggestions, what to do. So not just, you know, highlighting the problem, but also come up with suggestions. So maybe that's a bit of an awkward thing to do. You know, try, maybe you're afraid that you put yourself or you can expose yourself too much, but that's the only way that we're going to learn this. My third issue is with the availability of raw material. In other words, looking at terms of what South Africa has got in terms of raw material versus what we produce. And then also together with that, you know, you're talking about the imports versus the exports and, you know, that we should protect businesses, etc. Why? Why is that discrepancy there? Is it purely because we can't compete in terms of price? What is the cost factors that add to that? Because surely, eventually, when you've got a rand available in your pocket, you're going to look for the most value for that rand. And obviously, if an imported product gives you more value for that rand, you're going to buy the imported product. So what is the incentive then to really that we must buy a South African locally produced product? You mentioned that one of your goals is to grow sustainable employment. What does that mean in terms of, you know, qualify that for me and quantify that for me? In other words, put your head in the block and say, you know, this is what we can supply or, you know, bring to the table in terms of job opportunities, sustainable job opportunities. And obviously, you mentioned about your membership and the 35,000 people working. How much of those are big business? How much is small and medium business? Then my last point is on what you mentioned about the tariff manipulations. Obviously, from our neighbouring state, it seems that SALCO members and SADC members. But again, what should we do about this? A problem identified by various industries. What should we do? How should we deal with this problem? Should we impose tariffs? Should we have some dispensation within SALCO, between SALCO members? Should that be expanded to SADC members? What are your suggestions in that regard? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just
over to
Honourable
Kamalo. Thanks, Honourable Chairperson. My understanding of about 500 members is among others, your participants in the industry. I would like to get an understanding as to, in that 500 members, how many women do you have as participants? Two, your 35,000 employees, in locally and other neighboring countries, how many women, black miners, how many women do you have them as employees? Lastly, Chairperson, it is my question has been partly covered by Honourable Marais, but I would also like to have an understanding, because to me that it did not give sense to say you intending to grow a sustainable employment, but in which way, if you can just give elaboration on that. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honourable Kamala, Honourable Mabas.
Thanks, colleague Chair. Thanks for the presentation. I'm following up on a comment that was made by Mr. Raff on the universities and technicals. But at the same time, we say we don't have enough skilled people. In other words, does it mean our strategy is not working as a country? Because those institutions are supposed to give us skills as a country. Is there enough communication? Do you understand each other properly, yourselves versus universities, technicals? Is there a rapport and the Department of Labor? That's one. And then two, what are the chances of also covering rural areas, taking steel to rural areas? What are the chances? Then the last but one, we will agree as government that we should only import what we cannot produce locally. But is it not a problem of probably yourselves not marketing properly? Is it not a problem of not lobbying, not communicating? I mean, even over the TV, it is very rare where this message comes across from the steel industry, stainless steel industry. And then the motor car assemblies. What percentage of stainless steel that is used there is from the local production? Then the last one, but when I talk of the motor car industry, I also talk of government. Where government uses stainless steel, what percentage comes from local and what will come from overseas? Because we have got no reason to import if we can produce locally. The last one. What disposal mechanism do you have for scrap metal? And in that, I also include scrap cars, you know, that are lying around all over. Thanks, Colleague Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Judge, if you could just stick to one question as time is against us, please.
Thank you. Chair, first of all, it's very disturbing that we're not being able to beneficiate our stainless steel produced in the country. Unfortunately, the pages are not numbered, but on page 13, looking at the facts relating to the Holloway industry, now, in 2004, we produced 43% and we exported 67%. And the very next year, we only produced 18% and we imported 82%. Now, that's about, I can't see how this major shift from manufacturing to importing happened. What happened there? It's not logical as far as I'm concerned. Could you please explain that? Lastly, in terms of the subject rules of origin, if the pots and kitchenware is imported from Zambia or Malawi, there are rules. We have a free trade agreement with the southern countries. So there are rules of origin, and they can be used. Now, do our manufacturers know about it? Have they actually bothered to find out what these rules of engagement in the public region are? And what can we actually do to assist them? Thank you.
Right. It's over to yourself, Mr. Ralph, and you and your colleague, to, as a whole, to respond to this. Because I certainly see you having to come back to us in writing on a number of issues. So, please refer to those issues that you can verbally really deal with, and the rest will have to come back in writing.
Okay. If I may, Chair, just address them in general and not specifically to the questions, because I think I would be able to cover most. On the pots and pans, the Vietnam story, you'll find that there is an opportunity to expand it into a global market or into the potential lines there, because we manufacture products in this country called 430, which is a type of stainless steel which is an extremely competitively manufactured product, or extremely competitive in global terms. I think it would be fair to say that a lot of what arrives on our doorstep comes from countries where there are certain subsidies in place, and that issue is very much aware of it. The quality of the product as well is also at risk. However, I think the question that you asked is, can we expand it? The answer is yes, we can. There is potential to expand. There are three manufacturers, of which one is a major manufacturer with 400 people. He could probably triple his capacity within a couple of months, should the demand be there.
That was not my question.
I think all of us appreciate that we don't want you just to respond
specific.
So what we want is for you to be a little bit more constructive here. So if they can expand, why haven't they, for example? What is the challenge? What is the impediment to this expansion? You're coming here and you're telling Parliament that they can. Well, why haven't they?
No, Madam Chair, I think that's but I do believe that for the time given that we need to put the response in writing. So the question is well taken. To put the facts out on the table, I'm not in that position to do that. It requires an input from the association members more than me.
Madam Chair, I think my question was misunderstood, if I can put it again.
We're going to put it in writing, Honourable Ambrosini, because he's only got 10 minutes to respond to 8 questions.
To the Honourable Ventura, the DTRB are supportive, extremely supportive. We work with them on a regular basis. We involve them in the development of plans, and they respond to those requirements. We have a joint committee which meets monthly, in which we discuss the growth of the business. Insofar as the comparative costing is involved, I think it's best that we actually put up a schedule in terms of comparative costing so that you'll get an idea of what it is. On the economies of scale, there's segments of the industry that operate in that where volume, in fact, does help. The motor industry is a good example of that, on the stainless steel side of the motor industry, at least. But there are other segments where the volumes are too small to make it effective, and there's no doubt about that. In terms of new legislation on corruption, the response would need to be an industry response, and I think it's best that I go back and we in fact submit a proposal to Parliament in that regard. Raw material availability. Was the minor stuff of the question?
You asked about the raw material availability, and then related that to our competitiveness.
That's not what we are going to do. First of all, let's just have your mic on when you do respond, and come to check. Otherwise, they'll open up a market.
Right. I would just like to ask whether the member referred to in his question whether raw material availability is having an impact on competitiveness.
We'll check that after the member. Yes.
What I want to do is just to look at a comparison of what we've got available in terms of raw material, what gets exported, gets imported as a stainless steel product, and obviously in terms of local beneficiation of that raw material. If we don't have raw material, it obviously lessens your competitiveness or possible competitiveness. If we've got it here, it's obviously extra jobs that can be.
That question would be best answered by submitting a detailed matrix of a report on what we export as opposed to what we manufacture locally and the available raw material. But the majority of our raw material is exported in raw form.
Can you tell us the reason for that? We don't want bold statements.
The reason is that the market volumes in South Africa do not come close to the production capacity of the manufacturer. So it's about looking for the additional 40,000 tons versus looking to fill a plant of 700,000 tons. May I go on to the question was about job opportunities and the numbers. There are we have a detailed report on what we're looking at in terms of our initiatives into the industry on and. You asked not for bulbs, so let me be specific and submit something on it that's going to give you detail. The question about big business versus small business, the definition, big business is the likes of a corporation in excess of 150, or a business in excess of 150 people. And a small business in our terminology, or medium business is 150 down, and a small business is 10 and less. We're looking at, of the 500 members, 35 are regarded as big business. However, it must be borne in mind that those businesses are not necessarily dedicated to the production of stainless steel product. They are general engineering businesses. In terms of small businesses, we have a very, very small number of small businesses that... that participate in the association's activities. So the medium-sized businesses make up the bulk. The question with regard to SADC members, and so far as the solution is concerned, I think. Part of our role should be to assist government or those authorities to put in place the necessary mechanisms so that they can pick up on where these sorts of products are being manipulated or the imported product is being manipulated insofar as the tariff is concerned. It is quite obvious where these products come from, and we know that they're packaged in certain areas. But I think our solution would be for us to work with Customs and Excise in teaching and training and advising them as to what we could do. If you want details on it, we can give you the details in terms of volumes.
Yes. You know what we're going to do, Mr. Tim Ralph?
Yes.
You see, what we did request our committee secretary to do, and I understand that was done, similar to the Automobile Association term. No, it's virtually pointless having association come here, as it were, because they're in a vacuum. As you've just begun to tell us over and over again, you don't have that detail, you don't have that. A member will answer that. I mean, an expansion issue, you yourself couldn't clearly give us the detail there. Now, it's not helpful to yourself, and it's not helpful to us, not helpful to your association. And I wouldn't like to embarrass you, because we all want to be constructive here in these hearings. So we really need, outside of this meeting right now, for you to engage with our committee secretary to see how best you can represent the interests of your association. And also, by the next time we call you, bringing some of these players along, as others have done in the agro-processing, automobile, and so on and so forth. Because you cannot be an authority on everything. And I want, the steel issue is a critical issue in our country with regard to the acceleration of industry. And yet you come here in the most unprepared fashion. So really, I can't entertain this any longer. We're wasting our time. We've been here discussing this issue for more than 45 minutes. I want you to do justice to this and to discuss the issues with the committee secretary in this regard and to see how we can salvage this element of the public hearing. So can Mr. Hermans, will you do that, please? But I thank you for your time. Yeah, this morning, Mr. Tim Roth and Mr. Basson, Mr. Michel Basson, and we're now going to members move on at this point to Aspen. And I hope the pharmaceutical industry has come a little better prepared.
Honourable Chair, honourable members, good morning. My name is Stavros Nikolaou, and I'm here in a dual capacity today. Firstly, I'm a senior executive of Arkea Holdings Limited, and I also wear a different but related cap in that I'm the chairman of PharmEASA, which is the local pharmaceutical producers association. My presentation and certainly the invitation to present to the honourable members was addressed to Aspen, so this is naturally going to be an Aspen presentation. Having said that, I'd like to thank you, Comrade Chair and honourable members, for this opportunity, which we see as a very valuable engagement. And we certainly would encourage, hopefully you'll invite us back for future engagements, because I think these type of engagements, certainly from an industry perspective, are important in getting to the core issues. I've been asked to address the opportunities and threats in IPAC, and also to focus, so from an industry perspective that is, and also to focus on what some of the constraints are. So my presentation is really broken up into three parts. But I thought, as a starting point, I should give you a very brief introduction to Aspen Pharmacare. I really put the slide up here to depict one aspect of our manufacturing capability, which is in Port Elizabeth. Now, those the cluster of buildings, which is actually a campus, appears on your right-hand side, is in fact five factories. So there are five factories contained there. The building that is to your most immediate upper left is where close on 1 million patients receive antiretrovirals every month. It's also the building that achieved the world first in that the first antiretrovirals manufactured under the US FDA PEPFAR expedited review program were in fact manufactured in that facility. So that was a South African first. I think most of our detractors would have expected this to come out of Asia, and in fact that was achieved in that facility there. So just very briefly, who is Aspen? Aspen is the largest pharmaceutical manufacturer in South Africa, in Africa, and in the Southern Hemisphere. We ranked in position number 17 globally insofar as generic manufacturers go. That's ranking by value in terms. And we are an organization that is listed on the Johannesburg Securities Exchange. We're certainly a top 40 listing. And an organization that has made significant fixed capital investments in South Africa in particular over the past 5 to 6 years. Our CapEx investment in the last 5 to 6 years is equivalent to probably the entire investment of the industry over the last decade. So what are our manufacturing capabilities? I think very important in the context of industrialization, and certainly where we stand from a trade policy point of view. We have 16 manufacturing facilities spread across 5 continents. Importantly, 11 of those 16 are based in South Africa. Why do we have facilities outside South Africa, or what prompted us to have facilities manufactured outside the country? Our facilities are primarily in Brazil and Mexico. Both of those countries have high tariff barriers to entry. So if I want to export my product from South Africa to Mexico or Brazil, I'm going to pay a high duty. And that's the Brazilian and Mexican way of protecting local industry. So naturally, if you want to compete in those markets, you have to look very seriously at making factory acquisitions, which is what we did. Our capacity in South Africa exceeds 10 billion oral solid dose forms. That's what OSD stands for. What are OSDs? They're tablets and capsules. The current production capacity is a little over 8 billion. So that's where we stand at the moment. Of course, we've got flexibility around shifts that we can run. We often get posed the question, well, what happens if ALV ramp up doubles? You know, we don't have the capacity in the country. So, honourable members, I want to refute that statement right out today. South Africa does have the capacity. Given the right warning, the right time, South Africa can respond. There's no need to import these drugs. And then finally, I should just make mention that we supply currently on the contract, the state contract, close on 70% of the antiretroviral volume. So that hopefully just gives you a little insight into aspirin, a very quick and brief insight into why we need a strong local pharmaceutical industry. I think this will be obvious to the honourable members. But we sit in South Africa saddled with one of the worst disproportionate disease burdens. We've got the worst of the first world, and we've got the worst of the third world. So we've almost caught the Dupla there. It would stand to reason that we would require supply security, and we would need to have strongly developed our own capabilities and our own capacities in this country to respond to these tremendous challenges we face, which have a tremendous impact on the socio-economic environment in our country. The second thing to point out here is that the pharmaceutical sector is one that is characterized by a high level of import. So high that, in fact, pharmaceuticals and medical devices are the fifth largest contributor to the current account deficit. Current account deficit that we need to bridge. Because of the type of epidemiologies that we face in our country, the challenges thereof, it allows us the point that the Honourable Turok raised earlier around economies of scale. It allows us to develop economies of scale and efficiencies around certain therapeutic areas, particularly around infectious diseases and various others. So that gives us the capability and a platform with the right support to grow our export market. Growing the export market can certainly dent that current account deficit. I also want to point out, honourable members, that this industry is a highly automated one. It's highly automated, it's not labour intensive, and the value add here is in the economic value add back into the economy. It's into high-tech products that can be exported. It's into bridging a current account deficit that's expensive for the country. So that's where the value of this industry lies. And finally, our main competitors are Asian competitors who import products into South Africa. These products are usually subsidized through various a range of incentives that local producers, particularly in India, receive. So just to reflect graphically what I was saying earlier, let me handle the bar graphs first. And this is data straight out of the DTI. This tracks over a period of time, from 2005 to present, which countries were the main importers to South Africa in value terms. And historically, Germany, followed by the United States, followed by the United Kingdom, have traditionally been the biggest importers in value terms of pharmaceuticals to South Africa. If you go back 5 years ago, India didn't feature in the top 10. What's interesting is if you take year-to-date 2009, which was the first 6 months, half year, 2009, India had moved into position number 2. The latest data I'm led to believe is that now India is the single biggest importer of pharmaceuticals into South Africa. So it's overtaken Germany. So if I go on to the left, which tracks value movement over a 4-year period, 2005 to 2008, you'll see the black curve is the curve that has grown exponentially there. So that tells you that a lot of the imports, who we face as competitors out there, are Indian pharmaceutical manufacturers, who enjoy an unlevel playing field, to be frank, which I'll cover in a minute. Okay, I'm going to gloss over the slide, but this, because you've got it in your pack and you can read it in your own time, but this just depicts through a Genesis report that DTR, the presidency, commissioned in 2007. It places in perspective the value of pharmaceuticals versus two other high interest, from an industrial point of view, high interest sectors. And you'll see that pharmaceuticals are fared quite favorably there. Okay, I spoke, or I mentioned earlier, that when we compete against the Asian producers, we compete in an unlevel playing field. Why is that? Well, this is just a sense of the incentive that Indian pharmaceutical producers would enjoy if they export out of a special export zone in India. This is, well, the source of this is the PricewaterhouseCoopers Mumbai office. It's something that we asked them to put in writing to us so that we could have confirmation of the type of incentives that exist by competitors. And you'll see that the most prominent of the incentives is you receive an income tax holiday when you export out of those zones, so you don't pay any corporate tax. There's also an exemption of central sales tax, and there's a custom duty drawback in addition to that. They also have accelerated depreciation schemes which are applied. So in essence, if we're going toe-to-toe or head-to-head with an Indian exporter exporting their products to South Africa, they could enjoy a cost advantage of anything between 10 to 15%, just based on the income tax holiday alone. And I think what's very instructive, honourable members, is to place the economic value add into perspective. And the best way of me placing this into perspective is through a study that the DTR commissioned in 2008, when we were gearing up towards the 2008 antiretroviral tender. The DTR commissioned the IDC research unit to try and understand, to research, what the type of economic value add back into the South African economy would be if we manufactured antiretrovirals locally versus importing them. And although the study was redacted when it was given to private sector, I think what's interesting, or at least the sense that we got, is for every 1 rand procured locally for antiretroviral, approximately 30 cents more would go back into the economy vis-a-vis an importer. And an importer typically would be a 5 or 6 person operation. Might report to be empowered because they've done some transactions, or they've got, you know, a person of colour sitting as a receptionist and an admin manager. So it's quite easy to get a manipulation of that. So you could have a 5 or 6 person operation who's getting an advantage through the tax incentives, claiming maximum points when they tender, that's maximum preference points, and winning a tender because they might be 10 or 15 cents cheaper. And what gets overlooked certainly is the 30 cents of every 1 rand that's procured publicly that goes back into the economy. So that's the first aspect of my presentation. Let me concentrate now on the opportunities and threats that we saw as Aspen in RPAC 2. I'm going to cover the sectorial specific issues because I can tell you that in terms of the broader or macro issues, Aspen is aligned with BUSA, who have presented to you, and to whom you posed a number of questions, to which you are also giving input into those questions. So the 5 real areas of interest, whether they be opportunity or threat, in RPAP 2, are 1, and this is in order of ranking, to be honest with you, leveraging public procurement is a huge, huge issue for the pharmaceutical industry. Just given the burden of disease in a country, and given that most South Africans still depend public sector for their healthcare services. A very important issue, Comrade Chair, for me, is this issue of policy coordination across the various departments and ministries that need to implement policy. Far too frequently, policy has come out, get the industry excited, and get labour, organised labour excited, only to find that you depend, for example, on Treasury to implement it. And Treasury don't implement it. Or the Department of Health don't implement it. And you find that the various departments are not speaking to each other. Now, the problem with that, honourable members, is that these policy documents, like EPAP 2, doesn't only come to the attention of South Africans. It comes to the attention of investors and analysts overseas. When we sit and do analyst presentations, like we did 2 days ago, you get questions. You can say, well, why has this policy not been implemented? It's in black and white. You know, should South Africa be our investment destination? Or should we be investing in Brazil, where there's protection of the local industry there? So these are just some of the challenges that we face, just being absolutely practical here and being blunt, Honourable Chair. These are some of the challenges that we would face. And a lot of those are because we find difficulty around the departments and ministries that need to implement, the operational ones, are not necessarily implementing what's contained in the policy document. Developmental trade policies is an obvious one, I'll come back to that. And then CapEx incentive schemes, there seems to be a bit of a vacuum. You spoke of a vacuum, Honourable Chair, earlier. You use the same terminology as you. A vacuum between RPAC 1 and RPAC 2, I'll come back to that. And then sector-specific initiatives. Those are really the 5 areas that would affect the pharmaceutical industry in the document. As I said, by far, in my opinion, the most important one is this leveraging of public procurement. Now, the current public procurement system, which is largely determined by the triple PFA, the regulations of the triple PFA. In our experience, and I'm talking factually here, Madam Chair, I'm not being speculative, but factually, the way the system is set up leads to boom-bust characteristics, where 1 year you can win a tender for 10 million packs of an antiretroviral. So you make investments, you upskill people, you employ people on a production line, 400, 500 of them. And a year later, you could lose 10 million packs for 10 cents. Literally, that's what could happen. And I've got a real live example, the most recent one, that I'm going to share with you in a couple of moments. But that lends itself to boom-bust type of characteristics, which is surely not what the intention of preferential procurement is. It's surely not what we want as a society or as a country. So in a sense, often the tendering system can be deindustrializing, can shed jobs, shed skills, and can cause a loss of productive capacity in the country. And it's interesting as a corollary to all of this, that the state is procuring more medicines abroad than it is locally, notwithstanding the capacity that we have in this country. Okay, am I speaking factually around that? Well, this shows very definitively the study that was carried out, albeit it was using, you know, you work on 2 year tender cycles. So the most complete set of data we had was the 2007-2008 cycle. And that showed that 53% of medicines procured in the public sector, in value terms, are imported into South Africa. And what tells the true picture here is if you look at the bubbles that we've got there. Now, the bubbles depict the size of the tender, and they also map out the local content and the complexity of the product that gets manufactured. So the more complex the product is going to appear on the extreme right, the less complex, like a cough syrup, is going to appear on the extreme left. And you will see RT300, that particular tender, which is a blue bubble, which appears on the extreme left, is a so-called liquid tender. to one of the smaller tenders. It's a hassle for importers to ship water across the ocean. So they're rather going to focus on high-tech, more highly complex products, like cytostatics, so cancer drugs, which is the purple bubble which appears on the extreme right. So what is this telling us? It's telling us two things. Number one, we're importing 53% of publicly procured medicine in value terms. And number two, the plants, the so-called high-tech products, we tend to be importing more of those than the simpler cough syrups, which are far easier to make. So now I said to you, you know, this boom bust type of experience that we've had. You know, am I being speculative or am I being factual? Let me present a very recent case, which is the so-called family planning tender, which is RT283. That's the name of that particular tender. This tender was awarded at the end of November last year, and it came into effect in January. Now, Aspen has one of the few oral contraceptive manufacturing facilities in the world. It's certainly the only one in Africa, and I believe only one or two in the Southern Hemisphere. We manufacture under license from the innovator company Wyeth, which is a big multinational in the United States. Wyeth was recently acquired by Pfizer, incidentally. So Wyeth are now the largest pharmaceutical company in the world. So they've given us a license to manufacture these oral contraceptives in South Africa. We've got a state-of-the-art facility, and we've been making these products there for many years. We make five of these products, these oral contraceptives. Three of those, Trifazol, Nordetta, and Ovril, are a significant volume representation of what gets manufactured in this facility. And RT283 called for the following quantities in July last year, and as I said, the award happened in November. For Trifazol, 3.7 million packs, Rodet 2.3, Ovril 1.2, and so on. So a total of about 8 million packs was called for in that particular tender. Conversely, in the private sector, which is higher price, higher margin, lower volume, we sell about 500,000 packs. So you can see the bulk of the volume resides in the public sector. So now, what happens?
I'm going to just assist you in you've got your economic consequences and so on, which we're looking at. And so far, we've kept up to date on some focus and so on. And I think there's some critical points here that you do need to highlight. And, you know, we were hoping to finish with questions, etc., by 11 o'clock. So if you can watch that time, we need to give 10 minutes at least to the question side.
Okay, great. Okay, I'm just going to highlight one thing here. That Trifazol and Nordet, the tender for those two, was awarded to an importer, an Indian company called Famicare, who are subsidized. They won the tender through their local agents in South Africa. Their local agent employs about 8 people compared to an Aspen who employs almost 4,000 people. And the price differential for Trifazol, they were 51 cents cheaper, and on Nordet, they were 64 cents cheaper. So the saving on the estimated quantities that I gave you to Treasury was in the region of 2.9 million rand. So that was a saving. Okay. However, what was the loss to the fiscus? Without going into detail, because I've got time constraints here, but we've had to lay off some people, we've had to incur write-offs in factories, we've had to downsize our operation in East London, the oral contraceptive facility, etc., etc. And the loss to the fiscus, by our estimate, and I can't be accurate in absolute terms, because it's difficult to measure the indirect consequences back into the economy. But it certainly, in our minds, exceeds 10 million rand. So was that a good procurement decision for the country? I'm not sure that it was, to be honest. Yes, we saved 2.9 million, but, you know, I think we lost a lot more as a country. And that is why I've gone to Craig Lynn here to make this point, because there's a very important concept that's introduced in EPAM 2. And I've got to really pay tribute to DTR in this respect, because I find working with DTR, they're very responsive. Nimrod and his team, they listen, they want to, you know, they want to partner you, they want to take this economy forward. And I think they listened on this particular issue. Because we said at very least, what we should be able to do as local producers, if we face with a situation where our price is 50 cents higher, give us that opportunity to match. Because we might take a significant margin reduction, but it still secures our private sector business. But we don't lose the volume. Because if most of the volume is in the public sector, and you're taking your margin in the private sector because there's a subsidy between the public and the private sector, at least give us that opportunity. So this concept of point matching, which appears on pages 21 through to pages 23 of EPAM 2, is a very important one for an industry like ours that has great reliance on the public sector volumes. So just to summarize then on point matching, I think what's important, honourable members, is we get excited when point matching comes out. We phone Treasury the next day and we say, well, Treasury, are you intent on implementing this in the next ARB tender, which is coming up probably in 2 weeks' time? And, you know, Treasury are not necessarily aligned to this. DIH, not necessarily aligned to this. And it really becomes a challenge to try and get them aligned to this. And I'm not sure that we will. So my example of Lamivudine, which is 10 million packs that I was talking about earlier, using that illustratively, that could be lost for 10 or 15 or 20 cents in future. So I just really wanted to underscore that point. I think what we would like to see is more detail around how the point matching works. For us, it would be a simple concept of importer bids, local producer bids. If the importer's price is lower, local producer gets that opportunity to match. If you're able to match, you get the business. I think that's how we would like to see it, as simply as that. Just very quickly, Treasury have raised issues around whether point matching is constitutional. Particular reference to Article 2171, Constitution, Section 33 of Administrative Law. And I can tell you that we've got a very conclusive opinion from Edward Nathan, which I'm happy to leave behind here, which says on all five principles contained in Article 217, you can put a tick next to that. It's, in their opinion, it would not be unconstitutional point matching. Okay, I've covered a short-term intervention here, which is point matching in respect to the problem I've outlined. The medium-term, honourable members, we've got to get preferential procurement framework legislation sorted out in this country. What do we need to do to do that? It's for me a very simple debate, because it's always a to and fro between Treasury and DTR. Treasury saying, well, you know, what is that threshold? What is that sweet spot where we're in a fiscally neutral position? You know, is it 15 preference points? Is it 20? Is it 5? You know, where is it? And my only appeal is, as a country, once and for all, let's do a study that conclusively points out to what the economic value add is. If you've got to do it across sectors, that's fine. If we can do it globally, you know, DTR did it, and that was the 30 cents on the AC retrovirals to every 1 rand procured that I put up earlier. You know, Treasury, I believe, are not entirely happy with it. Now, let's just do one single study that everyone's happy with and everyone can live with. That will give industry the certainty and predictability we need. And if it works out to 13 points, honourable members, we'll live with that. At least we know what we get at. So that's just a plea on my part. And that's the only way I think we're going to get to the bottom of that issue. If we do that and we quickly amend the regulation to the triple PFA, then I think we can be back on track and give certainty and predictability that we need. Okay. Policy coordination, I've covered in great detail today. I'm not going to say anything more than that. On trade policies, literally wherever we go in emerging markets, and ASEAN's got businesses across the world, across all the emerging markets, we find that you're up against defensive tariffs. Yes, if you want to import your product into South Africa, you pay 0% duty. And every time I go to an IBSA council meeting, or an IBSA CEO's forum, or any of these other fora, they talk shop. So there's a lot said around we must have aggressive list. You know, our defensive list and what we're going to protect and what we're going to be aggressive on. And unfortunately, everything gets stalled. And it's a talk shop that carries on forever. And next month, we go to another IBSA summit meeting, and you'll have guys like Xavier Karim doing a lot of good work and all of that, but when you deal with the other side, the Brazilians and the Indians, it gets stalled. So we somehow need political pressure to bring these things to a head. So that we can say, well, if we've got to pay a 35% duty, or a 7% duty, whatever it is, this is what you pay in India, by the way. If I want to export my penicillin to India, that's what I'm going to pay as a duty. So if that's going to apply, either they remove it, or we apply a reciprocal defensive tariff. I'm going out on a huge risk here because I'm in a very sensitive sector. Because the minute I say, well, we want duties on medicines in South Africa, I'm going to have civil society up in arms. And that's not what I'm saying. I don't want to make medicines more expensive in this country. Absolutely not saying that. All I'm saying is, if we're up against Asian producers, and or Brazilian, or whoever it might be, the level field, the playing field have to be level, honourable members. Okay. Then just very quickly on CapEx incentive scheme. Okay. You're all aware of what happened with SIP 1, which was the old Section 12G, and that was exhausted, and we then went into a vacuum period where, you know, 12R should have been introduced, it hasn't been introduced, and it poses a lot of complexities for our type of businesses, because you can't put investments on hold. You can't say we're going to wait before we put up another packaging line for antiretrovirals when Minister Motsoaledi is busy ramping up. Can't do that. So you live in this vacuum. And then 12R might come along in a year's time, whenever it comes along. Okay, so we need to have that certainty around these CapEx investments. We can't be in a position where they're exhausted and then there's nothing for 3 years, and then suddenly 3 years later something comes about. Because in that 3 year period, we've had to make investments. We lose out on those CapEx allowances. I'll leave that in particular. But then the last point I was going to make is just around the specific sector initiatives that are contained in IPAC 2. By far the most, sort of the two most important ones, from a local producer's point of view, are to develop raw material, so-called API, capability for antiretrovirals, and also vaccine and other biological capabilities. Now, I've got to say that theoretically, these all make a lot of sense, because if you're going to have 2 million people, South Africans, taking antiretrovirals, and you're importing the raw materials, it doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense to do that. So I understand the logic and the rationale behind it. However, these type of investments will only work if they enjoy strong government support. What government support do you need? One, you need guaranteed offtake. If there are no guarantees from government that they're going to procure locally, you're going to be putting up a white elephant. Secondly, there's going to have to be a significant CapEx investment from government into this. Government might even want to own a stake in this, quite possibly, either directly or through a partner. And we're going to have to, as a country, make sure that we attract the right technology partner. It's a very complex technology. It's a changing technology. And unless we get these 3 prerequisites right up front, I don't think we would succeed with this project. So what I'm saying is, this project largely depends on our ability to have certainty around these 3 points that I've raised, and also the ability to get speed to market on a public-private partnership. If we get that right, then I think we can succeed with ALV APIs and also vaccine and biological production in this country. Okay, I've made in my final slide a number of key recommendations. I think they're pretty obvious.
Yes, and you've referred to all of them along the way.
Okay,
but
so
thank you for recapping them.
Can I conclude, Chief?
Yes, and you've now got 30 seconds because we really have not run out of time.
Okay, I think that the point that I need to stress is the last point, is that we as a private sector are committed to working together with government, achieving countries' objectives of economic growth, poverty alleviation, and reduced unemployment. And I indeed mean that working together we can, in fact, achieve more. And I think that working together also should involve, Chair, site visits to facilities, so that honourable members can experience firsthand the type of capability we have in this country. It's great for me to come here and verbalise all of these things. Difference, I think, if you see them in person. So I'd really like to try and encourage those type of field visits. And thank you for this opportunity and the privilege of presenting to you this morning.
You have had 45 minutes, so that's good. So what we are going to do is to take one question from three people. So I saw one hand only, two, three. Honourable Maria, Honourable Turok, Honourable Kotsi.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Very, very good presentation, so thank you very much for that. Compliments for that, really. Just on the CAPEX incentive scheme, have you given or submitted any specific suggestions and proposals to DTI on that? That incentive scheme, and obviously can you supply us with those details, because if you can see what is the requirements from the industry, and then together with that, just in terms of you know, maybe give us your, whether you've got a vested interest here, because you've addressed the chair as comrade chair, what does that imply, or you know, what do you, you know, That can be interpreted in a certain way, and maybe give us, you know, what is your interest?
Thanks, Chair. Just say thanks. Very interesting presentation. Although, as a committee, you will appreciate, we do have to be careful of special pleading. You know, many industries come here and present a glossy picture, and we have to be very careful that we're not influenced by special pleading. Although I'm not suggesting that is in your case. We have to look into that quite carefully. My comment really is to the chair and the committee. It seems to me that an important statement has been made about government coordination. And it seems to me that our report and our findings are going to be inadequate if we don't look into that. And I would like to suggest that at some stage towards the end of the hearing, we invite Treasury and perhaps the other department to come here and say an allegation has been made that there are conflicting positions taken by DTI and Trade and Treasury and others. And let's check that out, because if that is true, then of course IFAP 2 will not work. It depends on a coherent government. So I think it's a very important issue which shouldn't just slip past, and I'm sure the presenter didn't wanted us to take it seriously. The other issues on WTO and so on tariffs, they're pretty complicated, and I think that certainly the point matching case is self-evidently correct. Where there's equal weighting, you give preference to your own. I would have thought this committee would be very sympathetic to that position, and maybe DTI could inform us whether that principle, because it's actually a principle of policy of the government, that local is better and should be favoured. So perhaps DTI can tell us whether, in fact, this allegation is correct.
Thank you, Honourable Turok. Honourable Kotsi.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, in some of the presentation, the speaker did reminded me of the fishing quotas where you get, the fishing quotas we had before, where you apply for a quota this year and you invest, and the following year there's no quota, which was really an outcry, which we really need to look at. But I think on your side as well, us and
You have not indicated to us, we are aware that you've got 8,000 employees. While we expect government to do certain things, you also need to look at your own business as well. Because out of those 8,000, how many people, you know, I mean, how are you spread in terms of race, gender, and especially in high tech, that transformation is important because if we, as a portfolio committee, we know part of this is to make sure that we, the announcement by the minister that companies that employ young people will be incentivized, and those issues as well need to be taken into consideration. Perhaps in your writing back to us, you need to say to us how we are doing with that, so that we do not put issues to our government, whereas there's lots of issues that you need to be, I mean, I would be interested for me to hear, are there any other competitors locally in South Africa? And also, which countries do you import to, if there are any?
Right, thank you for the string. And just on that point of address, I think it's always proper in Parliament or in a particular setting. If my husband was sitting here, I'm quite certain he wouldn't be using the terms of endearment he uses in my home. He would also address me as Honourable Chair. And I think that is customary in any situation. If I was in my party, I would also expect to be addressed differently. So I think that it was probably an oversight. So I certainly hope it is. So it's over to you, Aspen, to respond briefly to in the next 5 minutes to the questions, please.
Okay, thank you, Honourable Chair. I think let me take them in the sequence that they were asked. I think to Honourable Marie, we've developed a culture at BUSA, of which I'm a trustee. I think in the spirit of trying to partner with government and organise labour, I suppose colloquially the term comrade is thrown around, and it's really in that spirit, that I made mention of it today. I think when we go to NEDLAC, we certainly very freely, as organised business, labour and government, refer to comrade chair. So I guess it was just a habit thing from my side. So apologies if there was anyone offended by that, but it's something that's quite common in NEDLAC, in fact. So hopefully that explains where that came from. Honourable Maria, I think I'd rather send you the proposals in the interest of time that we put to DTR on the CapEx incentives. I think we can do that. I can send you my submission we made, in fact, or send the committee at least. To Honourable Ben Turok, I think the issue around policy coherence I've stressed sufficiently, I think, how important it is. But I think what I didn't stress, perhaps, is that very often tenders go out before you can start getting any policy cohesion. And by that stage, the horse has bolted, and you've missed the opportunity. So what we try to do as an industry through NEDLAC, we call the Ministerial Roundtable, which NEDLAC convened last December, held at the presidency. It was convened by Minister Patel, and it was really around this cohesion issue. So I don't want to start making urgent pleas and be seen to be unnecessary influencing processes here. I think really all I wanted to say is it does create a lot of investor uncertainty out there. When policy documents come out, they get launched, there's a lot of razzmatazz in the media around them, and then overseas investors look and they say, well, you know, an ARV tender has been awarded and the policy wasn't adhered to. That's just really. Finally, Honourable Kotti, I think once again I need some time to do justice to your question. But what I can tell you is Aspen, in fact, employs 3,800 people in South Africa, not 8,000. We're a level 3 BEE company, and I'm happy to send the committee the breakdown of that. I do think, however, you raise some very important issues around skills. And where you do start seeing deindustrialization, you start seeing de-skilling. So there's a very serious issue around our ability to develop skilled industrial pharmacists, for example, in this country, relative to the curriculum that exists at pharmacy schools, tertiary institutions. So the more you're getting this attrition, because tenders are being lost, the more you're getting attrition of skills, the more difficult it is to respond to those skills challenges in this country. So I think that was a very important issue that you touched on, but I think I'll do more justice to it in writing given the time constraint. Finally, who, you know, are there other competitors, other local competitors? I think you meant South Africa. The answer is yes. There are other local companies. Some are large companies like an Adcock Ingram, for example. Others are medium-sized, and others are fledging empowerment companies. Companies like Spec Farm, for example, is a fledging company. Powered company, very small. And they face exactly the same challenges that we face around public procurement. Finally, which countries do we export to? Currently, we export to sub-Saharan Africa. However, we carried out almost an organization transforming transaction with the second biggest pharmaceutical company in the world called GlaxoSmithKline about 18 months ago. That transaction is going to enable Aspen to develop products under Glaxo brands, manufacture them here in South Africa, and Glaxo will distribute and market these products across 100 emerging markets. So it was really a groundbreaking deal. It's the first of a kind, and I think it's going to significantly ramp up our exports when it happens. And then finally, we export eye drops. There's a brand called Murine Eye Drops. You might or might not have purchased in your lifetime. Murine Eye Drops in the United States, second biggest brand, is actually manufactured in Port Elizabeth. And there's various other eye drops who are manufactured to the U.S. So I'd really like to extend an invite to you. Come and see our facilities. And, you know, I think seeing is believing. Excuse the pun on the eye drops there. Thank you, Jean.
Thank you very much. There are, as you say, some outstanding points to be responded to in writing. And perhaps one of them, you made a reference to the flexibility on shifts, that if one is given sufficient time, you're able to deal with any kind of quantity and whatever. And one must assume some form of standardization between the production or manufacture of production of these, whether it's eye drops or pills or potions. And so it would be useful to relate that to some of the boom and bust tendencies and this sort of thing. What measures are you taking in place? Are you putting all your eggs in one basket, as it were, or have you some form of diversification that may overcome some of the constraints that you've raised in this regard? The other thing is that with respect to the role you're playing, we're very happy that you came here directly from industry, but you also, as you said, are the chairperson of, if you like, some pharmaceutical kind of association or whatever, and maybe it being useful to make greater reference, if possible, to some of the other local industry players. You made a general reference to that, but perhaps in writing, just give us some of these other industries, whether what kind of rankings, and you did say the general challenges, etc. Are we looking at 5 others, 10 others, small, medium, and where are they in relation to yourself as the chairperson of the association? But I must say, this has proved helpful. Some of the points raised here about us looking at incentives as well as the procurement side of issues. And certainly we will put on the agenda the invitation to visit one of your plants. But clearly, well, that has to be factored in, and the whole committee has to look at that and see whether or not we can make use of that invitation and take advantage this year. But I do want to thank you most sincerely for being with us here this morning. And also to ask members to take their tea. I believe tea is outside. But I know we're running a bit late, and you were here before, etc. Can we just fetch the tea and bring it inside in the next 5 to 7 minutes? And then immediately begin on the next part of the program. Please, members. from our own researcher in this regard first, so that we would better be able, when the department gave us their input, to engage on it and have a clearer understanding. So we asked our researcher, the researcher deployed to this portfolio committee, to just brief us on trade fundamentals, trade policy and related matters. And I want to make it quite clear that this is going to be, as it were, twice annual, keep on almost in the nature of keeping us up to date. So I know Mr. McLungu was concerned that we would never be able to get everything on board in 15 minutes, so we have given him time. But I'll also look at VTI because I see that the time given to you was at 25 to 12, and I'm not sure if you have any challenges in regard to the committee running late, literally more than half an hour late at this point. Are you fine with that? So we're going to hand over immediately to Mr. McLungu. Let him complete the briefing, note the questions or comments, and then we'll engage. So it's right over to yourself, Lawati.
So thank you, Chair, and thank you, members. Chair, in the interest of time, I'll try to speed up this. I must first apologize for the distribution of the copies, late distribution of copies, as well as the volume of the presentation. Just the way in which it was printed out. The presentation is basically just to talk about the fundamentals. It's not an in-depth analysis of trade trends and just the fundamentals and some of the tools that are basically used in trade, which mostly from time to time we get to hear about them as the department presents. Now, the main idea of the purpose basically is just to understand what trade is all about. I think there are some questions of if you are importing, why, if you export certain raw materials or certain products, why import the same commodity? So I think to try and see, try and also explain some of these issues, and also the basic concept in international economics, which will also touch partly some of the issues on neoliberal economics or theory. Then look at theory versus practice and reality, and then trade trends in trade, mainly from the 80s until 94, and then I think the department will come after that on the trade, revised trade policy, 1994 on. Chair, some of the slides I'll just probably take 2 seconds on it, but some of the slides I probably would like to, you know, emphasize, put more emphasis on. And basically, international trade is an exchange of goods and services across borders or international borders. Now, this differs from your domestic trade in that there's mobility of factors of production, you know, all sorts of factors of production, labor and capital within boundaries. And also international trade is more costly than your domestic trade, just the exchange of goods and services within the country, not outside the borders. Now, why is it costly, international trade? Borders typically impose additional costs such as tariffs, which will explain in detail what tariffs are and look at how tariffs work basically. And also the time it takes at the border due to delays, which are the additional costs as well, and the costs associated with country differences such as language, the legal system, or the culture in those countries. Sure, if you look at some of the products that we buy from the, always find in the manual, there are all sorts of languages and stuff. And also you expect that at the borders. So those are some of the costs associated with your international trade that is trading across borders. Now, why do nations trade? It's the most fundamental question we ask. Why should nations trade? Now, Chair, I thought it would be helpful to explain this by, you know, starting first defining, explaining or discussing why nations export. And then also nations, why nations import, and then we'll find the reasons why do nations trade, and also give examples of why nations trade. Now, why do nations export? It's sometimes probably the issue of surplus production. Now, we find that the desire, a country may produce certain goods and produce in excess, such that the supply exceeds the quantity demanded or the consumption of that country. So there's that excess demand, I mean, that excess surplus, or that excess production, which then can be traded or exported to other countries. Made example of your Cote d'Ivoire cocoa. I find that the country has excess surplus of production of cocoa, so they usually import and export some of the surplus to other countries. Same as coffee in Latin America. The other reason why countries also export is because of the price differential, the differences in price of your domestic commodities versus the price of your international or other countries. And also, it's another way of earning foreign currency. We'll make example of countries when they import or when they export mostly. Two things happen when one exports. When one exports, is what happens is differentiate between the flow of goods and services to the other country and the flow of funds coming out of the country. So we always need to find, when we talk of your price differentials and any foreign currency, looking mainly on the flows of funds coming into this, more than just the flow of the goods and services. And then your price differential, there's a formula for calculating that. We'll explain that later on when we determine your terms of trade. I'll also give examples of how that is actually calculated, and also talk a bit about the exchange rate, because there's an impact on that. And also, the other reason why, and then also why do nations trade, explaining the other part, why do nations import, basically, buying goods outside the country. I think most of the presenters emphasized that the number of certain products have been imported. We problem with South Africa's importing, and that also is reflected in your current account. Now, countries import because of unavailability or insufficient quantities of the product. This is an example of the United States, which is almost self-sufficient, but it still has to import. It produces most of the commodity, but still imports. Now, one of the reasons for that, you find that the production of that, in this case, is now a reversal of some sort, in that your consumption of that actually exceeds, or the demand for that commodity actually exceeds what can be produced by that country. So that the difference between that then catered by the, your import of the services. An example, in terms of production, I think United States, as of 2007, United States is the third largest producer of oil, but it, in terms of consumption, is number one. In terms of ranking, it's the first country. So, and again, in terms of the 2007 figures, you find that your United States, I think the production, that is your barrels per day, is about 8.1 million per day. But in terms of consumption, is about 20 million. So there's a difference between 20 and 8. So that difference between 20 and 8 is actually comes from imports, and it imports oil from Saudi Arabia, Canada, and Nigeria, and other oil export countries in Texas, like Venezuela. So that's one of the reasons why insufficient quantities, more than just the availability. Other countries import because the commodities are not available in those countries. And the other reason why is because of efficient production, that is your means of production, and that will be determined by your methods of production. We'll explain it to it when it comes to the issues of opportunity costs and calculation of opportunity costs, and why countries would actually be productive in that sense. One example that we give is the issue of Chinese. We find that the Chinese, the production, they can actually produce commodities, the mass production, lowest cost, and when they export those commodities, or when we import those commodities, we find that they're actually cheaper than what is locally produced or domestically produced. So we find that we then import because of that. And that also speaks of your price differential as well. So moving on, Chair, just to touch a bit on the exchange rate factor now. There exists no single currency. So you have multi-currencies, and each currency has its own different values. They differ in values. Now, your nominal versus the real, that's another important point to note. If I take out the 1 rand and put it on the table and just sit there, that's nominal amount. So that's its face value. But now if I were to take out that 1 rand and then buy something, let's say for instance both items cost say 20 cents. Now the buying power of that rand, now filtering your price, would be about, if it's 20 cents, I'll be able to come up with 5 items. So that's the buying power of that 1 rand is about 5 cents. Then that could then translate into your view, the real value of that. That is basically your buying power. Now, this is what happens when there's international trade. Two things happen here. One is the first is the change or the purchase of the currency before one can purchase the commodity. So, which means there's each element of forex or foreign reserves there. So you demand and supply foreign reserves in exchange for the other commodity, for the other currency. And then you then buy those goods and services. And the difference is in the price. If you look at your nominal and your basically your real, or the differences in the prices between a country one and country two, it reflects your local market conditions, as well as your calculation of currency traders about the overall perspective of that particular economy. Now, if say for instance in a country they're expecting an inflation out, what you traders normally do is they will just sell those currencies, probably more or less like dumping them into it, and that has an impact on the exchange rate. So price differentials, or when you buy goods and services, imported, exports, has an element or has an effect on this on your price differentials, an element and effect also on your exchange rate. Now, just to give an example of exchange rate and the issue of prices and factoring your prices. Now, for instance, if say suppose 1 rand in South Africa is about, in another country is about $10. Now I'm using dollars hypothetically, I'm just an example, not particular country. Just assuming that it's 10 rand. Now if a can of Coke in South Africa is 1 rand, now and that same can of Coke is actually 10 rand in the other country. Now you see the price of the commodity is actually different. But then what then determines the exchange rate will be that the use of, we're looking at your weight in the basket and the terms of prices. So the rand exchange for the dollar is therefore 0.1. Can see that is your price differential now between the times. So, in the calculating the ratio of your domestic currency versus that, your domestic currency versus your foreign currency. Now, then your exchange rate then becomes 0.1 in that case. So, for every one dollar you change, you get 10 rand. For every one dollar you change, you get ten rand. Sorry, that's your exchange. So your exchange rate here in this case will be 0.1. Economists usually use what you call the purchasing power parity to explain the differences in the weight of those baskets using the prices, and just to explain they use that as an approximation for your exchange rate. That's just a little on the exchange rate. I didn't want to touch on much on the exchange rate because that's something else complex as well. So just to touch the effect of price differential in exchange rate when it comes to international trade, even though you import and export. Right. Then the question is, why then trade? Now, having explained the reasons why countries export and why the countries import, now having explained that, the question is, now, why then countries trade? Now, it's because of differences in natural resources, human and capital resources, combination of resources, how you combine those resources, that is, then speaks to your production method, the way we produce that, is an element of cost effectiveness, and therefore are not equally efficient. Countries are not equally efficient at producing the goods and services that the residents demand. And decision to produce any good or service has an opportunity cost, which will explain what an opportunity cost is. Also, we have some examples. And then given a choice, producing one good or another, it is more efficient to produce the good with the lowest opportunity cost, which will be better as comparative advantage. Now, just to make a simple example, now these two items, the pen and the bottle, now your country can have a choice of producing either a pen or a bottle with its given resources. Now, if you were to shift the resources from producing a pen to just produce the bottle, you forego the production of these by transferring those resources to that. Now the question is, how much do we sacrifice of the number in terms of pens to produce the number of bottles? So that is what we mean by your opportunity cost that is calculated. So that then determines your level of your opportunity cost sacrifice. trade depends on this opportunity cost. I always use a comparative advantage basically. So two terms of which are more, or sometimes use interchangeably, or a comparative and absolute advantage. There's a difference in that. Comparative advantage refers to the ability of the country to produce a particular good at a low opportunity cost. Now there's a difference between low opportunity cost and cost of production. Now this basically refers to the sacrifice when you withdraw resources from production of one commodity and re-employing them into the production of another. So that's the determining not the cost of production or way of production. The absolute advantage is basically countries produce a particular good at a lower absolute cost. Then that then speaks to the actual cost of producing that commodity. For instance, find that one country can produce 10 items using 2 people, where the other can produce, need 10 to produce just 1. So you can also look at which one is an absolute advantage. And we can also calculate the opportunity cost now. We also need some more information on that, which I'll come to now. And then the other terms of trade, which is the amount of goods and services that exports that must be given up to buy a unit of the other. But also, we can actually calculate the terms of transport, the prices of these commodities, the way we look at them. And also, terms of trade will also show your levels of that the country can produce and how much of it that can be imported for goods, the number of goods that can be imported for consumption. There's some definition. There was a question some time earlier, the difference between comparative and comparative advantage and competitive advantage. Now, what I found that comparative advantage basically talks of your opportunity cost, calculating the opportunity cost, which is the model in international economics based on the premise of that countries will export those goods that they produce relatively efficiently and import those goods that they produce relatively inefficient. Now, the competitive advantage, over and above comparative advantage, I think considers issues such as your labor productivity, wage rate disparities and such. So it goes beyond your comparative advantage and your comparative advantage. An example would be, I think we'll just use the example of containers at the harbor. I find that some countries, when it takes them 1 hour to load about 500 containers in an hour. We find that in other countries, they can load those in an hour, they actually load about 100. So that also gives you a competitive edge in terms of how soon can you get the commodities across the country. It also includes issues such as your transportation, your networks, as well as what happens within labor productivity. So that's the difference that I can come up with between difference between the comparative advantage and your competitive advantage. Now, by specializing in production, that is having calculated your opportunity cost and determined by your trade, your terms of trade, countries will engage in trade, and they see that that can also contribute, which is the neoliberals basically to advocate that can contribute to your increase in your incomes or your level of GDP. Now, that's another economic model of trying to see the connections there, that your consumption, which is basically consumption of goods and services, and your investment, especially in infrastructure, capital investment, plus your government spending could be on goods and services, and the net exports, assuming that you have a positive balance, then will actually increase your level of GDP. So changes in any of those components, CIG, positive changes will give your value of GDP. Now, say for instance, X minus M, the net exports, that X for exports, M for imports, if that's a negative, your current balance, your current account will be negative. So depending on your current account and the other values, it will determine whether you have a positive GDP or negative GDP. It's complicated. It involves a lot of other things like the multipliers and other things, but that's just the basics of the changes in any of those components have an effect on your GDP. Now, coming to back to the trade fundamentals, now dating back to 1776, now it says here by Adam Smith, It is the maximum of every prudent master of a family never to attempt to make at home what will cost him more to make than buy. So basically, look at three things here that come out from that statement. One is total of production. Like, why would you produce something that costs you more? I mean, having calculated the opportunity cost, then if you can actually buy cheaper from other countries, that basically talks of your consumption will be based on the imported commodity. So now, advocating that countries can actually benefit from trade, and says that if it costs you more to produce the commodity at home, whereas you can actually get that commodity elsewhere cheaper, so why then produce? So rather focus on what you can always specialize in commodities where you have the lowest cost, your least opportunity cost, and then the consumption of the other commodities will then be imported from other countries. Now, I'll use an example called the 2x2x2 model to illustrate this point. Now, the 2x2x2 model basically assumes that we have two commodities that countries can produce, the other two for two countries, A and B, and then the other two assuming that we have two factors of production, capital and labor. So those are the assumptions under this model, that if country A and B were to produce certain goods, now the assumption here is that country A can either produce sheep or bananas with these given resources. So if it decides to produce sheep, it will only produce 100 and 0 bananas. But if it decides to produce bananas, it will only produce 100 bananas and 0 sheep. So it's a case of A either or. Now, if country B, on the other hand, if it decides to produce the same commodity, say either bananas, sheep or bananas, if it decides to produce with these given resources only sheep, it will only produce 25. And if it decides to produce only bananas, it will produce only 300. Now, in fact, countries may want to produce a combination of both. Now, if, for instance, A wants to produce sheep and bananas, it means that you'll have to forego some of these resources in order to produce more of the other commodity. So now, by means of calculation, which I'll show you now, calculating the opportunity cost. If, say, for instance, country A were to produce a combination of sheep and bananas, if they were to produce one sheep, they won't be able to, with the resources left, they won't be able to produce 100 sheep. So the ratio of the 1:1. So they forego one sheep to produce one extra unit of bananas. Whereas the country B, if they were to produce one extra unit of the other commodity, they will forego about 12 units on the basis of calculation. So forego about 12 units. So in terms of opportunity cost, it makes sense for country A to specialize in the production of sheep because it forgoes one unit to produce one extra unit. But for B to produce the same, it forgoes 12 units to produce one extra unit. So it doesn't make economic sense. So it rather specializes in the commodity where it is the least comparative advantage. Now, this assuming that it's in a closed economy, where your production is equal to consumption, your demand is equal to supply, and this is the production, and the total production of these commodities will be, in terms of shares, if they just produce shares, given their resources is 125, but if you produce bananas only, given those resources will only produce 400. Now, suppose these countries engage in trade, free trade. Now, then that speaks to which country then specializes, based on your comparative advantage, which country will then specialize in the production of that. Find that A will then specialize in production of shares because of the least opportunity cost, 1:1. Whereas country B will then specialize in the production of bananas, which is the lowest cost, it is the least opportunity cost in producing bananas, about 0.08, whereas there's 1.1 in there. And then the total production in that, when after specialization, increases in terms of shares, it becomes 200 from 125, and in terms of bananas, increases from 400 to 600. So that's the impact of specialization in this. And then once these have been produced, now what happens when these countries are produced? Initially, when you look at country A, its consumption of sheep is actually 100, but now it produces 200 because of specialization. So which means if we're to take 100 in terms of consumption from that, it will be left with 100, and that can be taken to be your excess production, which can then be imported to the other country. Same as country B, initially at 300 bananas. Now, if now they're producing 600 and assume that the consumption is still 300, there will be excess production of 300, which then be imported to the other country, imported by other country. So that's the effect of the impact of trade. And after trade now, that's the result of trade. Country A then consumes 100 units of sheds and 300 units of bananas. Initially, they will only either produce 100 or produce 100 sheds or produce 100. But because of specialization and your openness to trade, they now consume a combination of both 100 sheds, which was the initial, and extra units of bananas that were produced by the other country based on its comparative advantage. And then the total production then increases, same as 200 and 600. Now then this trade, I mean, looking at that example, we see that trade can actually benefit countries. Then comes back to our questions, why do countries trade? Even though a country can produce the same commodity, I mean, produce that commodity, it can still import that same commodity based on its your comparative advantage. Right, now this is a graphical presentation of that table, where you have the production, the second part, this just is your transformation curve, which determines your production, and then that line is your PX or PY, your terms of trade now, and this is where the country can produce at that level. And then what accounts for and only consumes at that level. Now what accounts for the additional, that consumption which is outside its economy, outside its production capacity, will then be imported from the other country. So it's just a graphical illustration of what was happening in that table. Now trade deal in practice. Question now is really, is this comparative advantage or this trade, is it in practice, does it really happen? Now, some of these issues, countries do not specialize exclusively in the production and export of just a single product. For instance, that example, it just showed the 2x2x2 module, just two commodities. So countries specialize in quite a number of commodities, so they're not specializing mainly in just one. And the countries produce at least some good or services and the other country can produce more efficiently. So it talks of issues of a country may have the least comparative advantage in terms of production over the other, but may still have problems in terms of trade. And this is a problem with mostly economic developing countries. A low-income country might, in theory, be able to produce a particular product more efficiently than developed countries, but that country might not be able to identify potential buyers or transport these items cheaply to developed countries. I think that then speaks to your competitive advantage. It may have comparative advantage, but it loses out on the competitive advantage. And then that also creates trade division and trade division that is shifting from a country where there's efficient production because of its competitive disadvantage competitively, then the trade then shifts to another country which may be less efficient. Generally, countries with a relative abundance of low-skilled labor tend to specialize in production and export of items which low-skilled labor is the predominant component. We should find that in most African or developing countries, it's your manufacturing, agriculture, or your labor-intensive. We tend to specialize in those commodities. Same as your countries with relatively abundant capital tend to specialize, which is mainly your developed countries. You talk of your manufactured goods. Now, regulation. Now, governments often try to manipulate flows in a number of ways. May restrict imports by means of tariffs or quotas. May encourage exports by means of subsidies. Now, just to explain a few things here. Examples of quotas. One example, I think, Chinese. An example of Chinese on the way to America. I think there was the 2007-2008. I seem to be corrected in terms of the year. The quantities that the issue about quotas is that once you exceed or once you supply to the country or that country or if you exported the quantities that agreed a quantity before the end of your say calendar year. Once you've produced that, then it means the remaining months in that calendar year, there's no transaction or there is no flow of goods and services. This was not the issue that Chinese faced in the U.S. in terms of underworld. I think that time came before the end of calendar year, and then there was fear that the community might end up with buying expensive underwear which is produced locally, whereas they're enjoying the commodity coming from China at a reasonable price. And then the issue about subsidies. Now it makes two examples about the United States and the EU, in the European Union or the European Commission subsidizing the Airbus company, and the United States complained about the subsidy that it's unfair for EU to actually subsidize this. But EU's response was, how is it unfair? Because the Boeing in the United States does a lot of business with government, so indirectly being subsidized. So those are some of the impacts or the issues about subsidies or subsidizing a commodity. And you also have issues which are the Doha round, where the issues are around subsidies, especially in the agricultural products, where most of these developed countries were very protective in terms of that, and were subsidizing their farms. And one of the issues that came out was a cow in Japan is subsidized about $7 Canadian dollars per day. And now, if you have to export this commodity from a country like African country, a developing country which is not subsidized, now it faces artificially low prices there. And if you want to make a profit, you cannot charge the prices that actually in those markets because you do that. So it has actually pushed out or forced a lot of African or developing countries out of business because of this subsidy. And one of the arguments is that if you talk about your poverty line, that is your $2 per day, how can these developing countries preach about aid coming to developing countries for development purposes and to alleviate them from poverty, whereas they're subsidizing a cow for $7 Canadian, and that's even more than double the amount of your poverty line. So those are some of the arguments that come out in this discussions of the on mostly the trade negotiations. And then the tariff was also used to restrict imports. I'll explain in detail the tariff as we go along. And then it has also been said that tariff may be used as a political tool. I think in 2002, United Steel tariff imposed a 30% tariff on those, and also I think Australia in 2007, they also imposed, I think the Australian federal elections in 2007 also used the imposition of tariff to support the local. I think they're using that as a tool for political purposes. I will not elaborate further on the political issues.
I was just wondering, this is a parliamentary research report. I think perhaps it would be better if we had access to it, read through it, and then discuss it. We have a number of people from the department that we don't often get, so we need to interact with them on a more lengthy basis. I don't know if it's at all possible that we actually take these people. We have our researcher. We need to go through the documents and then engage. I don't think we'll be able to do that.
Right.
If you may
Now, I have heard you. We took a decision last year that this is what we would do, but the two issues had been separated, which is why I raised it. We do want to just refresh our memories for another 10 minutes before we get into that. And I think it is important for people to have a clearer understanding. We're not going through the whole document right now at all. We did have certain workshops last year. Of course, some members like yourself were not members of the committee at that time. So we are going to, in fact, finish up to a particular section which takes us to the after the joke page and the impact of tariffs. And just before you engage with the graph, it doesn't have a page, but it's called Free Trade Importing Nation. And before we come over to the department itself. So we have had some fundamentals last year in May at about this time. But as I said, this is in the sense of refreshing us, and I think it is important that our own researcher assists us in refreshing this. The department are here to engage with us. We oversight them. We don't oversight our own research at this stage. So I don't want to enter into a debate, but I do want us to complete up to those three slides.
Thank you, Chair. In the interest of time, I'll take the next 15 minutes, and then I'll give a few slides. I think the department will also speak to on those issues, especially the trade, the trend, which is most difficult issues. And then just to, some of the slides I'll just show and then skip them, I won't explain. Special types of tariff, I won't explain this in the document, so this is just some of the tariffs that are important. Those are the definitions, yes. Now, tariff classifications. Now, it's what's called the harmonized system, an international system for classification of products. Right? And it uses a six-digit code, which is about 5,000 articles arranged in 97 chapters, grouped in 21 sections. And the HS6, the harmonized standard code is standard, but countries may add more codes because national distinctions. It may have eight. I think the United States has about eight, four after that. They can have an eight code, you can have ten digit codes. And the greater the level of the specificity is referred to as the national tariff line. And I just and to explain, this is just an example of how this HS6 code looks like. So your first two digits, which represents the chapter in which goods are classified. For example, you have HS09, it just represents the chapter. The chapter is coffee, tea, spices, and other contents, etc., under the chapter. And then your HS4 digits, which will now be HS0902, represents, now this basically talks about the groupings within that chapter. The chapter is 9, then your groupings now become 2, then it explains further what kind of tea in that chapter is it, in this case, whether it's fermented or not. And then your HS6, which will now be HS09020, this elaborates on the type of the commodity, specifies the product itself. For instance, if you take the digit 10, it says it's clean tea, not fermented, in immediate packings of contents not exceeding 3 kgs. So countries may also go beyond that, elaborating on these tariff lines. Now, the impact of regulation, some of the issues of regulation, which I will not explain in detail, just flash through. Tariffs are advantageous to domestic. Now, this is in theory. That tariffs are advantageous to domestic producers. They reduce competition, cause prices to rise, increase in price, stimulus production, and then. That's basically what the impact of tariffs are in the world. Now, the impact now goes beyond that. It reduces consumers' buying power, which will explain how your consumer surplus is reduced and increases your producer surplus. So some of the terms that we use. And then it causes a decline in the economy. And then we'll explain by means of a diagram how that happens. And then two things that come out in the initial imposition of a tariff. One, you can look at the imposition of a tariff from, or the impact of, or to the economy of the country with the tariff imposed on. And you can look at the impact of that tariff on the country that imposes the tariff. Now, from this, the impact to the economy with the tariff imposed, it raises the cost of domestic production. Because now it means that for that country to buy that commodity, or when they import that commodity, it's going to be the price plus the tariff, or especially if you talk of your input. It reduces the supply of those products in foreign markets, it forces producers out of production due to a reduction in the demand for that specific commodity. And jobs are threatened, lots of producers are reduced, or as producers reduce production. The impact of the that's the impact. Now, I just thought of this, just to illustrate a few things. I think it's in the paper, it's clear what it means, that speaks basically about protection, you know, protecting certain countries. You can speak of free trade, but now when other countries want to join in that free trade, then you say, we're protecting these other areas, so it's unfair trade and those things. Now, the impact
I think it makes a critical point about this. They have all the rules, and it's who decides to keep what rules that seems to operate. You know, this sort of sums up a lot of the theory which we're getting into, and I thought it was a very useful slide that you identified, and so on. And it is the crunch and the crux of the matter that we're right in right now, and I'm sure the department itself will confirm those difficulties, but more specifically. So what I'm going to ask you to do, Mr. Matlangu, is to just close off before you reach the next, the graph, and just in 3 points to raise those critical issues. You've ended with the crux of the matter, and if you would just raise the three things that we need to take on board as we move into here, what the department says. And then I would ask members to study the document seriously, apply their minds. This is not empty theory, it is applied theory that we need to utilize. So just over to you, Mr. Matlangu, just to give us those 3 points.
Thank you, Chair. I just quickly then go to the last slide. Second last. Now, I attended a speech for presentation yesterday on the destructive cost of EPA. Now, these are some of the issues that that came out in that presentation, which I thought maybe would be important for the chair, for the committee to also discuss moving on. Now, there was an issue of the EPA running parallel to the WTO Doha round. Now, what was happening here is that most of the issues that developing countries rejected in the Doha round seem to be coming through the EPA, the issue of procurement and stuff. So those are some of the issues that maybe we can then look into, the committee can look into what were those issues in the Doha round rejected by developing countries were deemed to be a challenge and now coming via the EPA. Then the issue of trade blocks, now to revisit the Abuja Treaty, which was signed in 1999, where the African states commented that we should have 5 trading blocks. Now, why is the EPA coming with the 6 trading blocks and taking the vulnerable ones and grouping them together? For instance, taking some of the countries like Zimbabwe out of SADC and then grouping them in the EFA, the Eastern block. And then the signing of interim EPAs. Yes, some countries have already signed the interim EPAs. Question that is, one of the key issues that was raised yesterday was the issue of, yes, they may have signed for certain reasons, but we should be careful when it comes to your most favored nation clause, your export taxes, and aid for trade. And when it came to aid for trade issues, we also were going to look into that, because one of the findings on aid for trade found that the idea is open your trade, open up your market so that we can trade, and then you'll be aided or your aid will come. But the study found that the only two countries that actually benefited from that actually is Afghanistan and Iraq. So I think that's something that also can be looked into. Then your neoliberal policies, no nationalization, open to market. Now, this is one of the questions that came out that, I mean, these institutions, the World Bank, IMF, and now the WTO, the multilateral trading system, have been preaching about neoliberal, open up your markets, deregulate on those. Why are they now coming up? Now they are nationalizing, their banks are being bailed out by government, they are the most protected areas, but they've been preaching that, do not protect these markets. So that's something that also needs to be looked at. And then for the committee to revisit Article 24 of the WTO, the GATT, which talks about regional integration, I think one of the issues raised there is that the issue raised in Article 24 is that the regional integration issue on gas on services. So I think it's about liberalizing capital or your financial services. We've seen that coming from the 1929 the Great Depression. How do you liberalize those kind of things? And also, one of the issues that came out is the European Union grouped themselves under that article. But now when developing countries are starting to group themselves, why then the European Union now revising that article, tightening it so that it becomes impossible for these African states or developing countries to integrate? That's one of the articles that needs to be revisited. And also, one of the issues that came out is to focus on the weakest links. Found that the weakest links in the EU, the PIGS, with regards to Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. And any changes in that, especially in the financial sector or your, that environment, regulatory environment, if it's weak, it may pose a threat to the European Union. So those are some of the issues that came out. And the question that was asked is, who needs who? Does EU need Africa, or is it Africa that needs it, or is Africa that needs EU more? And the question was, who, if we reject EU, do we benefit from that, or EU benefits from that? So those are some of the issues. Because now, one of the points that came out here that needs to be looked into is that EU or the developed countries are now desperate. That is why they are coming up with all these sorts of trade or bilateral agreements to try and compete with the emerging economies like China, India, Brazil. So those are some of the issues that came out in that. I think, Chair, that's all I can say.
I'd like to thank you for all the work you've done in this regard. I know it's really been intensive application, and I'm sure the committee would share our appreciation of the document, which can keep as a resource in our hands. And from time to time, we will engage you and in that post. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, can I just a brief comment? I've just glanced through the rest. In my opinion, this is an incredible, very important document. Unfortunately, it is in a presentation form, and one is not always sure that everybody will be interpreted in the way, you know, just by reading through it. So in terms of what I've heard and what I've seen, this is actually something that you need to do actually right in the beginning of a year, so that you have got a glance of where we're coming from. What is the issues that face us? What is the reality? Why are we losing jobs? Where are we losing jobs? And that, I think, will focus us much more in terms of what do we need to do. So this is incredible. It's actually a pity that we can't go through the rest, because what I've seen is, and there's obviously a lot of questions that one can ask, you know, in terms of deliberation on certain points and tariffs and that, because there's a lot of hypothesis here, and obviously a couple of theories as well. But there's a lot of incredible, critically important, basic stuff that we actually need to know and understand.
You will recall, Honourable Maria, that we have said, even now, we're coming back to the document. We've got enough to chew on, get through, and either on the 19th or just close enough to that period, but before we finish with the public hearings and so on, we will go back to it. But it's like a number of things. I noticed when I used to lecture that, you soon have to check to see how close people's heads are to a desk when you're really trying to engage them on very serious matters, and that may require for a slight shift, because of course people, unlike robots, can really only focus for up to 45 minutes at a time. I'm sure you all know that from your university and your trench warfare days and everything else. 45 minutes focus, and then a song, and if you're doing academics, you crack a few jokes or force the professor to crack one. So there we are. That's the limit of our focus. All of us know that sitting here. So, and we're not academics. You know, we're honourables, as they say, or members of parliament, and activist members of parliament, if you like, from every party, may I add, because I think even yourself, Honourable Maria, you're busy tramping around in the community, and that's the definition of an activist parliamentarian these days. So, I mean it sincerely. Take him the opportunity to sit next to you. But on a serious note, Honourable Mr. Mthlangu, just make sure this document is at the ready every time. And I only have one point to say about the graphs. Of course, they read like a dream to myself, but I do know even the size is helpful. But it'd be good to share the graphs with a joke or two. And then we will have this and we'll try and go through this. So we are coming back to it. I hope I'm making myself clear. Right, now over to the department. And if the department would like a copy of this, they're very welcome to it. But I'm sure you took one already. So we're going to over to yourself then, Mr. Karim.
Opportunity to present today. I understand that this is the initiation of a formal consideration of South Africa, the documents that the department has prepared on South Africa's trade policy and strategy framework. I think members will recall that the department did present this document, a much longer version of this this presentation. I believe it was in October last year. It was a little bit of a preview of the document that we were working on and trying to finalize, but I think there was an opportunity for us to present to the honorable members what we have been working on. So as I understand it, today's meeting is essentially initiating a formal consideration of the document. It will be the subject of, I believe, one or two public hearings where comments will be taken on that, and then a report from the committee would be drafted in respect of this document. As I said, this presentation is quite brief. We've stuck faithfully to the format prescriptions that the committee has. Sent us. This is a summary of a 90-page document, which I believe has been circulated and members would have had the opportunity to look at. But before I go into the presentation, perhaps just to give a little bit of a background on the process that we followed in preparing this document. The decision to prepare a document like this was taken in around mid-2007. We, under the guidance of the then Deputy Minister Rob Davies, now our Minister, we convened a reference team comprising a number of departments across government with some interest and expertise in on-trade policy. We brought in some experts from outside of government to participate in it and essentially to give guidance on constructing the document, what the shape should be, what should be the key elements, and also to make contributions to that. The reference team itself comprised the Department of Trade and Industry, led mainly by the secretariat, was provided by the International Trade and Economic Development Division. We had National Treasury participating, Agriculture, Foreign Affairs, the Presidency, with the South African Revenue Services participating, the International Trade Administration Commission that participated in the reference team. But we also went beyond that and consulted with departments and other interested players along the way. And there have been at least 8 or 10 iterations of the document over the last few years. And as I've indicated, we have presented moving towards the final draft in October last year. It was presented to Cabinet in November last year. If I'm not mistaken, it was the 20th of November, where Cabinet then indicated that we should consult further on the document. Cabinet also made a number of recommendations that we needed to include in the document, and Cabinet also then said that once these additional consultations were concluded, we needed to bring the document back to Cabinet this year, and now a date has been set for April that we're required to bring the final document back to Cabinet. We've also initiated in November, once Cabinet had considered it, we initiated formal consultations in NEDLAC. Because of the intervening holiday period, we only received comments from business and labor constituencies last week, but we think that we can accommodate most of those comments in a final document that we would eventually send back to Cabinet. I think the main thing, before I turn to the presentation itself, this document aimed to do several things at once. I think in broad terms, there has been a sense, there has been a sense that there has been a lacunae in South Africa's overall policy framework. We didn't have a definitive statement on trade policy that had been at least from the government's perspective. Many, many documents are produced, there are many papers about trade policy on South Africa, but we didn't have a document, a recent document that outlined South Africa's approach to trade policy. I think the second element of it was that we also thought it was necessary to have a review of our trade policy and trade strategy over the last 15 years. So we have also tried to do that. And then I think the third key objective was to clarify how trade policy in South Africa could contribute to South Africa's broad economic development strategy, with a particular focus on trying to draw out some of the links that are necessary in order to support our industrial policy. And we recall that when we started this process, the industrial policy documents had just been released. Since then, we've had, as you're fully aware of, you were talking about earlier, we've had two action plans emerging out of that industrial policy, which has given additional guidance to the interlinkages between trade and industrial policy. I'm going to go relatively quickly because the document itself is an extensive document, and to try to summarize or highlight any particular areas would be quite difficult. We've stuck to the format that was described, and so we'll go relatively quickly, but I'm happy to, with my colleagues that are with me, Tembi from the department, Penny sitting next to her from the department, from ICED, would be, I think between the three of us, we should be able to answer any questions. Okay, well, I could just go through it. Hopefully you can read around it. But essentially, the first slide is just to outline at a very broad level what our national objectives are. I think they've been articulated in a number of documents. Clearly, I think the ITAP has articulated it most clearly that our objective is that South Africa's economic to implement an economic development strategy that aims to accelerate growth along a development path that generates decent jobs. From this perspective, the trade policy, we are making the point that trade policy must support industrial development and upgrading, must contribute to employment growth, and must contribute to increasing the value add components of our exports. The second or third key point that we make in this is that we've adopted, and the document itself elaborates in some detail, we've adopted a developmental approach to tariff reform in support of these objectives. We've also taken the point that in terms of our trade strategy, and this refers really largely to our international engagement at a national, at a regional level, at a continental level, around the world, that our trade strategy and our international objectives must be geared more closely, must align more closely to meeting our national objectives. I think one of the real difficulties that one has in a document like this, it's a framework document, is that we're not attempting to try to answer every question that relates to trade policy. There are many issues that one could draw in. There are questions of infrastructure, there are questions of transport, there are a range of questions that relate to an effective trade policy and as part of your suite of economic development policies. But this document doesn't try to answer all of those areas. Many of those are the competence of other departments, other government entities, etc. But what we do try to do is to provide an overview, provide the parameters of our trade policy and our trade strategy, and to give a sense of the key thrusts. Obviously, there's a lot of detail that would go into each one of the elements. In terms of the structure of the document, we spent some time doing an international review of the ingredients for success in the current global economy in recent times, characterized with growing and intense international competition. What have been the ingredients that have contributed to developing countries' success recently? We've looked at recent theoretical literature, so there are introductory chapters that sort of set out the framework for that. The document then goes on to outline, to assess the extent of tariff liberalization that South Africa has undertaken since 1994, and we come to the conclusion, I don't think it's surprising, I think everyone is quite aware of this, is that South Africa since 1994 has undergone extensive tariff liberalization. Again, we do some analysis of what has this meant for our trade, particularly from an export point of view, and it shows, I think the significant finding is that it shows that while South Africa's exports have increased since 1994 in most years, the basket of export goods has remained largely unchanged, with some exceptions. If we look at our basket of products per region around the world, in every region our exports are dominated by commodity exports, raw materials, primary products, except in African markets. And in Africa we have a more diversified set of exports that are made up largely of value-added manufactured goods. We spent some time, as I've indicated, on trying to clarify the approach to future tariff reform. this has been partly in response to a number of calls that we've been hearing over the last few years that one of the reasons for South Africa, that South Africa has not managed to grow as fast as it needed to, was that our tariff liberalization process had slowed down after 2000. And there were a number of calls from a number of quarters indicating that what we needed was another burst of tariff liberalization, continuing to reduce tariffs, in a unilateral way and in terms of a big bang approach to tariff liberalization. And I think this elaborating some of these points were what we thought was important to indicate that tariffs are in fact instruments of industrial policy. They have implications for capital accumulation, technology change, productivity growth, and employment, and that one needs to adopt a strategic approach to tariff reform in a way that it more fully supports industrial and employment objectives. The approach that we articulate, the Minister has made this point, I think, a number of times in this House, is to adopt an evidence-based, case-by-case assessment of tariffs to see what the implications are for the economy, for the industrial sector, for the firms, and that we don't adopt a priori position either to liberalize or not to liberalize. We look at it on a case-by-case basis. And this approach, this kind of approach, is embedded in ITAC, in the way the International Trade Administration Commission operates, in fact. So in a sense, what we're doing is we're underlining the importance of ITAC in examining and reviewing tariffs. If there are any guidelines that we would look at, again, this is not definitive, but guidelines constitute the last two bullets on the slide, that we would consider tariffs on mature upstream input industries could be reduced or removed to lower the costs for downstream labor creating manufacturing. And I think we've already begun to see some evidence of this approach in practice. We've also taken an approach that another guideline would be with tariffs on downstream industries which have high employment or value addition potential. These could be retained or even raised to ensure sustainability of the sector and for job creation. Now, when we talk about raising tariffs, and I noted in some of the earlier discussions this morning, there were suggestions that we should raise our tariffs, and there is space to raise the tariffs in some cases, but we need to recognize that we have international obligations, trade obligations in the WTO, but also in our bilateral agreements with the European Union and SADC and EFTA. That creates some limitations to that. This is a slide that covers an enormous amount of work that the department does and that South Africa is involved in, and that's with respect to our trade strategy. And obviously, each one of these are elaborated in a lot more detail in the document that I believe members would have an opportunity to look at. I depart from a premise that a global economy that is generally supportive of developing country developmental objectives would be broadly supportive of South Africa's economic interests. So addressing the kinds of overall imbalances in the global economy, addressing the imbalances and inequities in rules, that many developing countries are seeking to address would benefit South Africa. We spent some time going into our approach to regional integration in Southern Africa and Southern and Eastern Africa. We've highlighted the importance of SACU, SADC, the proposal for a trilateral free trade area between SADC, EAC, and COMESA. But we've also identified the problems that we see in each one of these regional groupings. I hope the acronyms are known to members. But SACU is the Southern African Customs Union. It's the Southern African Development Community, SADC, and then it's SADC plus the East African community, COMESA, which is a broader, I'm actually not sure what that acronym stands for, but
yeah,
it's an East African.
Here,
it's an East African, it's a common market, East and Central Africa. East and Southern Africa. So it's a regional grouping that encompasses some of SADC members, but it goes all the way up the East Coast, it encompasses, goes all the way up and covers Egypt. So there's a suggestion of a free trade area, or discussions about a free trade area there. And then, obviously, our trade and investment relations in key African countries, even beyond the members of the SACU, SADC, and East Africa, some of the key countries in West Africa, in North Africa, are important to continue to build those relations. And the focus in Africa has been on building productive capacity and supporting cross-border infrastructure development, amongst others. Beyond Africa, the countries of the North, the U.S., the EU, Japan, and other OECD countries remain important. They remain important markets for our exports. They remain important sources of investment and technology. And we need to continue to consolidate our relations with these economies. The document makes a strong case, I think. And again, I think this is in line with the minister has made this point on a number of occasions. That in the current global environment, we are seeing a shift in global economic strength to countries in the south, in particular Brazil, India, and China, amongst others. There are other fast-growing economies in the south, and that we need to find ways of diversifying our trade relations. I think already last year we saw initial figures showing that China has become South Africa's number one trading partner. So there's clearly a structural change underway in the global economy, and we need to build those linkages in a way that support our industrial development and support complementarities in our trade. And then finally, on this, the pursuit of a developmental outcome in Doha. And the point that we've been making over and again, I guess the key point is that a developmental outcome is more important than an early conclusion. And essentially what we've been facing in the last few years is a lot of pressure from a number of quarters for early conclusion of the Doha round. But our concern is that by doing so, we're not going to get the full developmental impact out of that. All of these points are elaborated in some detail in the document, and again, I'm just trying to summarize it at an extremely high level. The document then goes on to talk about a future work program on trade policy. It identifies a number of areas where we have realized that there's inadequate research, there's inadequate preparations in South Africa, and many of these issues we're confronted with them on the international trade agenda, and South Africa needs to start to prepare in a much more intense way. We have prepared, we have engaged in these issues in the past, but I think it has been largely defensive, and we need to perhaps prepare in a way that would allow us to be more proactive in some of these negotiations. Areas trade in services, the trade aspects of investment, trade and competition, the trade aspects of intellectual property, trade and procurement, trade and labor issues, environment and sustainable development. And I think we have developed positions in many of these areas, but what we probably haven't done is clarify the trade aspects of each one of these, and this is the work that we have set out for the next phase of work on trade policy. One of the areas that we thought is important, and we picked this up by our engagements with a number of trading partners, is to understand a little bit more clearly what the links are between trade reform and more broadly structural reform in an economy, and the effect on workers that would lose their jobs, or sectors that would be that would close down. We thought that this is an important point to elaborate on, and we're probably going to need to work more closely with the Department of Labor in trying to elaborate some of that. The other point that we raised, and I think this is obviously of interest to all of us, is to strengthen and clarify the institutional arrangements for trade policy making. We have a number of processes already existing. Some of these overlap. Some of the linkages are probably not well elaborated and strengthened, but we wanted to do some work on how to strengthen trade policy making at the intergovernmental level, in terms of our interactions with Parliament, with our constituencies in NEDLAC, with research institutes and academia. And so we've outlined in the document a range of initial proposals, and I must say this is just really initial. We didn't want to preempt this discussion, but we want to identify these issues as areas for further work. As I indicated, Chair, the Cabinet had looked at this document in November 2009. We've included their comments into the version that the committee this committee has looked at. The Cabinet's comments have been included. As I indicated, we had NEDLAC comments. We received comments from NEDLAC just last month and early this month. We're working to accommodate those, and our expectation and hope is that we are able to meet the deadline set by Cabinet to submit this document in April. That's the presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, in fact, Mr. Karim. Thank you. I think what members will recall, I mean, this is, if you like, a PowerPoint highlighting the key points of a very large document which we've had for some time now. It's not something we received yesterday, but some of you may just need to refresh our memories around the larger document. Sometimes an input on a PowerPoint input assists us in going through a much more intensive, detailed document. So, but I would advise us to link the two together. Now I'm just going to, what we're looking at here is questions, comments, in relation to a more holistic understanding of where this does link with industrial policy action plan and also the framework. So it's over to yourself. One will allow a lot more time this time, perhaps up to three questions per person. Honourable Maria on my left, Honourable Mabasa on my left, followed by Honourable Hajjaj on my right.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I think this is an absolutely critical document, and this policy is crucial for us to move forward. Obviously, the devil is in the detail, and once we interrogate things now, we will come up with more of those devil issues that we will have to deal with. The one thing that I've identified, and that came up from this morning's submissions as well, and Mr. Karim, maybe. I mean, I would have that requirement. There's often real transgressions in terms of WTO guidelines and rules, and sometimes it is perceived transgressions. I think we have seen this morning the pharmaceutical industry has indicated how many subsidies there are, and it means that, you know, we don't really protect them. And I think we will have to get to grips with that as well, because there's currently an incredible negative aura around South Africa's role in representing and protecting our industries within World Trade Organization. And the perception is some guys feel nothing for that. They just go on with normal business as usual. So we will have to know, you know, what is our role there, what we can do. Then obviously, there's certain phrases that we often use, and I think it's so important that one must know, or at least try to understand what you mean and imply by certain things, so that you can just, you know, get to grips with those things. The two issues that you can maybe just explain to me, you know, but what that really means and implies. The one is decent jobs. What is decent jobs? And the other one is what you mean and imply by developmental approach. There's so many definitions. There's so many departure points. There's so many people that has got this meaning and that meaning, and eventually we must know what you mean and what your objective is, that we can try to at least untangle it in that perspective. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Comrade Chair. My first question is on page 3, the very last bullet there. South Africa continues to be dominated by commodities, except in African markets. I understood the input, but what I couldn't understand is what is it that enables us to export these goods to most parts of Africa, yet not be able to export the same goods to other parts of the world? Are there no parts of the world that are at the same level of need as those to which we do export? And then the second question is, in all our attempts to avoid unintended consequences, do we keep in mind BBBE, but noting that it is very easy to go the wrong way in fulfilling BBBE, where we don't necessarily narrow the inequities? Because I think our biggest problem, amongst others, the element of inequity within the BBBE. And the one but last is that as we trade, to what degree can we control real investment versus speculative investment as people, as we import, in that exchange. And but then the last one is it that we are not marketing ourselves properly within our country, where people do not necessarily appreciate the difference between buying local goods versus importing? Or is it that we as government are not necessarily sensitizing producers enough to a point where they don't necessarily, in other words, I feel we are not supporting local producers adequately.
First of all, I would ask Mr. Kazim to comment on our rapid kind of liberalization. Has it adversely affected, I think, has adversely affected some of our manufacturing sectors? And what is our thinking on that, taking into account our new industrial policy? That's the one issue. The other issue is, in terms of the subject trade protocol, is that actually assisting regional economic integration? And what is our role therein? And what kind of challenges are we facing? And the last one is that how successful are we in South Africa in promoting our Nepal commitment, especially the trade and development aspect, in terms of our commitment to the development of the region and Africa as a whole? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And just one from myself in relation to the tariffs and the WTO and protectionism and so on. How does the WTO regard support for various, whether it's industry, agriculture, of course it's also industry, but various sectors in relation to development finance assistance, development finance itself. In short, if development finance was offered at a very, very low interest return rate, would this still be regarded as a subsidy to a particular sector, industry, or what? Sorry, Honourable Kotsi, I didn't see your hand.
Thank you, Chairperson. In terms of what Lwazi was inputting here earlier around the international trade trends, he mentioned some of the reasons why countries trade, and one of that was exporting. And that was done because the surplus production. When you link that in terms of theory and the input given here earlier by people from Aspen, you can actually see that there's theory and practice that is not linking in terms of the theory that was given by God. The second issue I want to maybe see how you comment there is South Africa imposed import tariffs on China goods, and there was this agreement signed in 2006. What have we learned from that as South Africa? Did we benefit from that, and what have we learned as South Africa around that particular agreement?
Thank you. And also, Honourable Hagebe, before we hand over to the DTI and Mr. Karim.
Thank you, Comrade Chairperson. I just have two questions to ask. In particular, from the previous presentations we had on IPA in particular, there's a strong movement that our exchange rate, but in relation to the currency, is hurting our export market. What is the opinion of the department, in particular this unit of the department? And then number two, it was the issue of subsidies. We know that in the Doha Round you raised it, but really, what is worrying me is the issue that seemingly when you take decisions there in Doha Round, you depend upon when are the elections going to be held in England, when are the elections being held in Brazil, when you speak about subsidies in particular around agricultural issues. Are you not strong enough to just make your point so that our products are protected? Because really, if you can go to a cow of England, which is subsidized at the pound level, you look at the rate of subsidy which is there, and the amount which is there, you can see that these subsidies are criminal. There is no way in which our products are going to penetrate that market. So what is it which you need on our side to do, in particular, as Parliament, to come and soften that blow on your side? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the members for their questions, some of which I'm not sure I'm going to be able to answer comprehensively, but we'll give it a try, perhaps with a bit of reflection, we'll maybe able to come back with more complete answers later. I think the first point Honorable Murray had raised about the devil being in the detail, I think is absolutely correct. But one also finds that in many of these issues, it's actually also the solutions lie in the detail. The approach, again, to reiterate that the approach taken in this document is not to go into all the detail. All of these sort of broad issues that we've touched on are the subject of an enormous literature and debate and discussion and negotiation, and it's not possible to be able to reproduce that here. So what we've tried to do is just outline some of the general thrust. On the question of transgressions in WTO rules, my response would be that we need to be very clear when we say that there's been a transgression of WTO rules. Subsidies, for instance, are defined very precisely in the WTO, and prohibited subsidies are defined precisely. Now, in the history of these negotiations, if you were to go back to the history of the Uruguay round, for instance, and where the agreements were negotiated, they were negotiated in such a way that they tended to cover those types of subsidies that now developing countries were beginning to use. And the types of subsidies and more sophisticated forms of support that industrial countries were beginning to use or have been using were left out of the definition of a prohibited subsidy. So, for instance, in subsidies for research and development, subsidies for environment support, subsidies for, you call it regional development, but it was an attempt to allow Canada's support that it provides at a provincial level not to be touched by WTO agreements. So when you look at the history of these agreements, they were responding to very specific interests in the negotiations that were shaping the outcome of that. Now, that's where you begin to find the inequities in the agreements. It's not that the subsidies agreement, a discipline on subsidies is one thing, but where you find certain subsidies are being disciplined, and those are the ones that the developing countries are more likely to want to use, as opposed to subsidies that industrial countries would want to use. So, I would say that there are inequities in that, but one would have to be very careful in making the argument that there is actually a transgression of the rules. And so where I've heard that there are subsidies, countries will say, well, China's products are subsidized. You need to do a proper investigation in terms of the rules that are set out in the subsidies agreement in order to find it there being a transgression. There may be something that is unfair about it, but whether or not you can prove it and you can actually address it depends on again, the devil is in the detail. So I think the point is well taken. One of the areas I didn't mention in this presentation, but I think we're going to need to think about it, it's been raised both by labor and business in the NEDLAC consultations, is that South Africa thus far hasn't developed a capacity to seize our rights under the WTO. We're very clear about our obligations, but we haven't built up sufficient capacity to challenge under the WTO, under the dispute settlement procedures, where we feel that our rights have been violated and we need to take advantage of that. Many other countries, Brazil is active, India is active, China increasingly is active, many other countries challenge the trade policies of their partner countries if they feel that they are violating WTO rules. We haven't built the capacity in South Africa yet to do it. There is capacity, but I don't think we, I think we still have some way to go. Now that's part of the, and I think in the next edition of the Trade Policy Review, there will be a reference to beginning work on building some capacity on dispute settlement, or taking, seizing our rights in terms of the dispute settlement in the WTO. I don't have offhand what the definition of a decent job is, and maybe I'll ask my colleagues to help. But I understand it, that it would mean that it meets the basic conditions of work that is legislated, that these jobs are sustainable in the long term. But I think there's probably quite a specific definition that's been attached to that. But I'll be prepared in the next version of the document to clarify that, maybe in a footnote or something on that. On the developmental approach, I think when we talk about developmental approach, my understanding of it is that it would apply to the way that we approach tariff reform. One would not only look at it from the point of view from necessarily an efficiency point of view of trying to lower costs or improve competitiveness only, but one would look at it from the point of view of what it does for the longer-term development of the sector. It may mean in some cases that you would keep tariffs, even though it has a cost to the economy. You may decide that you want to keep the tariff because you're trying to develop the sector. It may mean that you would forego government revenues because you want to keep a particular sector that you think is important going. It would apply to the way you approach the negotiations in the WTO. You would prioritize the impact of particular negotiating positions as having a purely commercial intent, or one that has a developmental content. And one would need to look at it in terms of agriculture, in terms of industrial tariff negotiations, the way you approach intellectual property rights negotiation, etc. So again, it's a broad developmental approach, and I think again you would define it in the particular engagement or the particular negotiation that you're talking about. Certainly if we're talking about the EPA negotiation, and there is a proposal from the European Union in that to eliminate export taxes, one would argue that that is not very developmental friendly. So you would oppose it. So your developmental approach would say, you know, don't accept this. If the proposal is to limit the ability of, and certainly in the EPA there are proposals that border on this, if not directly attack it, that would limit the ability of the South African government to use procurement for the purposes that I believe that Nimrod may have already been speaking about. There are proposals in there that would limit South Africa's ability to use procurement for development. Now, clearly that, from a developmental perspective, one would resist that type of proposal. And the list goes on. It depends on the detail. Honorable Mabusa raised the question about why is the trade profile different in Africa as compared to other parts of the world. And again, these are generalizations, but I think in the document, there's actually quite a useful, I found it very useful myself, a very useful breakdown of our trade per region, per country, and how it's evolved over the last 15 years. And that would be useful. But to answer the question, I think it's probably the primary reason would be that, comparatively speaking, African countries import dependent for many of these manufactured goods, for these capital goods. They would import from the rest of the world. They would import from the US, the EU, Japan. But because of South Africa has some competitive advantages in some of these sectors, autos, some capital goods, machinery, amongst others, and our advantage is the fact that we're close. We have the costs of getting our goods, we may have an advantage in some cases over some European partners. But again, one would need to look at it in detail. But the fact of the matter is that when we look at this, look at our trade around the world, with Asia, it's dominated, the exports are commodities, Latin America is commodities, Europe dominated by commodities, and etc. And in Africa, it's a little bit different. Honorable Mabuso has raised a question that I'm going to struggle with, and I'm not quite sure how to answer it. I'll try to draw out the links between black economic empowerment, the triple BEE, and trade policy, and perhaps I'd need a more clarification on what you're trying to, how you're seeing the linkage there. It's not clear to me. I understand the policy, I understand that it's part of the suite of policies in the department and in government, but a direct link to trade policy, I think I'd have to spend a bit more time thinking about it. So perhaps I'll be forgiven for not being able to answer directly at this stage, but we can say that give us more time. The question of marketing South Africa's goods, this is again not, I suppose it's related to the work that we do, but it's not primarily the work that ITEF does, and it's not primarily a trade policy issue. It's more of a promotion, I would interpret it as more of the work that we do in terms of promoting our exports. And that's the work that is done by trade and industry and investment South Africa, our sister division in the Department of Trade and Industry, who are much more involved in taking delegations around in different countries around the world, promoting South Africa's exports, try to market South Africa's exports, and perhaps they may be able to answer that question better. That is one of their primary tasks, is to market South Africa better. What I can say that we're trying to do is that there seems to be a more concerted effort amongst government departments to do this more in a more coordinated way. With the department, the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, DIRCO, the Department of Agriculture, with provinces, there is an undertaking to try to do a stronger, a more targeted and effectively coordinated marketing South Africa abroad in general. And the question of not supporting local producers, I'm not sure if you meant in terms of our trade, in terms of our trade promotion. There is some support for taking South African exporters abroad, trying to expose them to international markets. There's funding through TISA on small SMMEs, taking them abroad, trying to show them, give them offer opportunities for them to interact globally, to expand their trade. But in general, SMMEs don't export. They're generally setting up internally. Am I taking too long?
No, not at all. I just wondered if Honourable Mabasa didn't want to just clarify the question a little bit more, so that even though you may not be answering or responding to us, it would be something to go away with. Honourable Mabasa?
Thanks, Comrade Chair. No, when I said that there could be the unintended consequences as we trade, South Africa trading with other countries. But at the back of our mind, we also have to say we are not just aiming to win on trade purely, but we must also say concurrently what is it that we must set in place such that trading also addresses our inequities. Because I believe if that could be done, it would be on a bigger scale. I'm aware that it's something that should be entertained by you know, various players, various departments. But because I thought if it's ignored completely, it means we will find what, 3, 5, 10 years down the line, we then say, couldn't we have tweaked this a bit better to have a bias towards addressing this problem?
And if I understand correctly, Mr. Karim, you're still responding to some of the other questions, right? So if you can't do justice to this right now, you may be able to, in a bilateral, as well, with Honourable Mabasa.
Chair, I think the clarification is helpful, and I think my answer would be would be at a broad level again. I think that. The point is to mainstream trade policy in our broader development strategy, which includes addressing advancing black economic empowerment strategies. So again, I think one of the points for clarification in terms of the strategy, and you I think you've helped us, we can try to make that clarification in the document, how these relate. At a broad level, probably not at a detailed level at this stage. The next question that I picked up was Honourable Hajjaj on the tariff reform experience, I believe, and what I understood. I think what the analysis has shown is that South Africa has liberalised extremely rapidly. I think the figures will show that something in the region of 62% of the tariff lines in South Africa, in our tariff book, in the classification that was presented to us earlier, 62% of the lines are currently at zero, which means that South Africa doesn't charge duty on around 62% of our tariff lines. Now, out of that, about 20% of those lines, if my figures are correct, are bound at zero under the WTO, which means that we would not be able to raise those tariffs on those lines beyond zero, beyond zero, without paying some compensation to our partner countries in the WTO. Because we're breaking a commitment that was made in the required round. What it does mean, though, is that there is some scope to raise tariffs without breaking our bindings on the other tariff lines. However, in order to do that, I think the approach that we've been taking is, as articulated when we're talking about the approach to future tariff reform, is if there is a proposal to increase a tariff in a sector or on a product, it is something that would need to go through the type of investigation and analysis that ITAC provides. And recently, ITAC has raised, after having done investigations, has raised tariffs in a number of products, but on a greater number of products, we've actually reduced tariffs. On the basis of what an assessment of the economic analysis of the implications for the sector would be. So I think the point I'm trying to make is that there is scope for raising tariffs in terms of our current obligations, but we would do so within the context of, first of all, our WTO obligations, but also on the basis of economic analysis. The SADC trade protocol, I think the main point we would make is that we've probably been much more successful in addressing only one of the three key elements of our SADC integration agenda. The three pillars of the integration agenda from a South African point of view, and it's set out in the overall SADC agreement, was a trade liberalization element, an infrastructure development program, cross-border infrastructure development program, and policy coordination, particularly in the area of industrial policy, but also agriculture and a number of other areas. It's probably easier to reduce your tariffs. It's a lot more difficult to coordinate your industrial policy. It's a lot more difficult to get up and in a sustained way develop the infrastructure. So when you, I think if we're making an assessment of what has happened, we can say that 85% of goods in SADC are now traded free. 98% of South Africa and SACU's imports from the region and from SADC, from non-SACU members, enter the SACU market duty-free. But if you look at the composition of that, if you look at the sort of imbalance, overall imbalance in trade, South Africa still exports 7 times as much to the region as it imports. That fundamental imbalance hasn't changed in the last 15 years, which points out that the most fundamental, the most significant constraint on addressing the imbalance and the low levels of intra-SADC trade is the lack of capacity, industrial capacity in the region. Despite having an open trading region in Southern Africa, the countries don't have the capacity, agricultural capacity, industrial capacity, to take advantage of that. So as far as going forward, we prioritize. It's not an easy job. By no means is it easy. But the point that we've been arguing is that the focus going forward must be on what we need to do to build capacity, production capacity in Southern Africa. So that's on the agenda. The other elements of it, I think there was a midterm. There's been a midterm review of the implementation of the SADC agreement, and that identified 3 areas that need strengthening and improving. The one is strengthening rules of origin. The second is improving customs controls, facilitating customs movement of goods across borders. There are currently enormous delays at the different borders, and this is an area that's been identified as could significantly improve trade in the region. And certainly our business operators, if you speak to South African operators that trade in the region, this is one of their persistent complaints, that they are not able to get their products across borders in quickly enough. And then the third area is developing a common standard for products in the region. So that is the kind of agenda, I think, that we've prioritized going forward. It's not easy, because it's not South Africa doing it on its own. For all our good intentions and objectives, we have to work with 15 other governments, some of which may have different priorities, there may be differences in capacity, and so that's quite a difficult process. It's our work in SACU and SADC that I think probably gives the most meaningful contribution to the objectives that are set out in NEPAD. The integration programs that we're doing, the focus that we want to give to production capacity building, our ability to make a contribution to those NEPAD objectives are going to be felt much more in the region than, for instance, our engagements in beyond the region. We have a structured agreement in SACU, in SADC, and many of the regional, the NEPAD projects and the NEPAD priorities are reflected in the approach that we're taking in the region. The chair has raised a question about developmental finance and whether or not these can be considered subsidies. Again, I think a proper answer would need a good legal assessment, because the agreements in the WTO, this is something of a grey area. There were a number of cases between Brazil and Canada some years ago about preferential loans granted to Brazilian companies below market rates. And there was an attempt to try to clarify that. The Brazilians managed to sort of knock out the claim by pointing to a range of other subsidies that Canadians had in support of their industry. And so again, I think it really depends on how it's structured, and it's a grey area in the WTO. I think what you could rest assured about is that even where there's a grey area, if there is an adverse effect on a trading partner, questions are going to be asked about that program. It may not be prohibited, but if all of a sudden, as a result of this type of financing, we start to take market share in another country significantly, that country is likely to start to raise questions about that. And we've seen that in the past. A number of loans which we thought are completely WTO legal, financing schemes in the past under the IDC in the 90s, late 90s, were questions were raised by the US as to whether or not these constitute prohibited subsidies. We managed to stave off those challenges, but you can be sure that those questions could be raised. The Honourable Kotze's question about the discrepancy between theory and practice, I think that's entirely evident in our experience, in our international engagements. Countries preach free trade on the one hand and the importance and the benefits of free trade where it suits them. But where they lack competitiveness, or they're not able to compete, they are quite prone to restrict trade. I think the cartoon that we saw earlier was precisely that. And so I think if we look at each and every country, there are sectors where they impose protection. Sometimes it's overt. Sometimes it's more. It's more difficult to find, but countries all find ways of protecting their sectors where they're uncompetitive, and then they demand free trade in sectors where and product lines where they are competitive. So I think honourable member is completely right about that. On the MOU safeguards with China, I think probably the first point to make on that is that was an option that was only available up until the end of 2008 to be able to apply quotas on China, because this was something that was somehow covered in the WTO, in the terms of China's accession to the WTO. It's a discriminatory, in general it would be considered to be WTO incompatible, but because many countries had concerns about China's competitiveness when it joined the WTO, China was treated as a special case for a period of time. And that lapsed at the end of that, on questions of quotas, etc., that would have lapsed in 2000 and at the end of 2008. I think the idea of the safeguards was a good idea to try to give some breathing space to the industry. This is not an area that I mean, focused on directly from our unit's point of view, but I've heard the anecdotes I've heard about it is that this did provide relief for some producers. Probably we needed to ensure that there was greater alignment in terms of providing support for some of the industries in the sector, but certainly some of the evidence shows that this did help the industry in distress. The question, the Honourable Radebe raised a question about the exchange rate. I think this is something that the department has taken a view on. I think it's set out in IPOP, in the industrial policy document in 2007. It's been raised in IPOP 2, and essentially the concerns have been raised is the volatility of the currency, the fact that it's overvalued, and that it that inhibits our exports and encourages imports, undermining our industrial development objectives. And the approach clearly is that we need a more competitive exchange rate, but clearly this is a subject of further discussions in government. It's not directly a BTI only issue. I hope I got the questions. I think I've tried to cover. Thank you, Chair.
And certainly, from the questions that were asked, I know you indicated yourself you wanted to come back perhaps to one or two others after studying the question in a little bit more detail. But I'll look at the members themselves, because I think this also leaned on some of the fundamentals that we have taken on board, as it were, and then also looking at this for the first time, a very extensive document and the PowerPoint trying to highlight these issues. But if some of the questions, if you still have further questions relating to some of now the fresh responses, I think it would be well for us to keep them on board when we have the public hearings and so on. I know that members of the department perhaps in that area will be here during that time. And often the odd bilateral does help as well, and for us to take it further, because I do think that it's going to be very important for us to more and more relate what is happening on trade to industrial development, but also the whole issue, the skills component issue, does that not also come into, if you like, the comparative advantages that we have or that we don't have as we speak? We heard, as you were here perhaps yourself, you may have heard some interesting points or rather the Steel Association tried to make some interesting points this morning, and I think they had some very good intentions, and they will be coming back in this area. But one is alarmed to think that some of these commodities don't get value added here, therefore are not made competitive, or for some reason don't seem to have a comparative edge somewhere. And yet we seemingly have the commodity itself and the facility to undertake this. I think of some of the areas we hope to engage with again in these public hearings, such as transport, where it's been made clear already in these public hearings that large organizations, including parastatals and spheres of government, are making these purchases outside the country. And it's not clear as to why they're making these purchases. You know, is the product here so inferior or so costly or so uneconomic? What is the problem that we're not able to respond domestically to these needs? And why do we have the current imbalances that we do have and other countries seemingly operating like pirates on the global sea? While we're still in a defense mode with hardly any armor. I mean, it puzzles me that we should be so defenseless. But you did capture some of the points yourself here, Mr. Karim, and I don't think that we have had sufficient time to digest it all. This is a highly, you know, it's a huge document for us to get through, and I want to urge members to study this now that we've had the PowerPoint engagement on it. Those of us in the Labour Portfolio Committee, there is so much in here, in transport, in economic development, and in many, in agro, anyone, I don't think there's anyone sitting in the Portfolio Committee of Agriculture, you see. And certainly there is an international relations. So we don't have people everywhere in terms of this committee, but I do know that many of us have come from rural areas and must have some understanding of agriculture. So I'm hoping that we engage directly. I am going to take the Honourable Mabasa, but I do want to thank you most sincerely, Mr. Karim, for your patience in listening and in responding, and also being open to engaging with us in the future. But let me just, before I close, take the Honourable Mabasa.
I'm following on the point that you are making to say, shouldn't we consciously have a register of goods that we are able to produce as a country? And because as government, we are procure most goods as government, right across, the whole of South Africa, all the three spheres and the agencies. Is it such that there is freedom for all? In other words, if I'm in a certain agency, I can decide what to procure and what not to procure and from where, because if that freedom is left to everybody, some people may, because of lack of knowledge, they may not see that it is a priority to promote South African goods, sometimes unconsciously or consciously. So I would have thought that it is the DTI that has to play a bigger role above most, because it is strategically placed to have this bird's eye view over other departments that may be more ignorant.
While I certainly find that very valuable point, I'm not too sure that just whether all the data would be forthcoming directly from yourself, Mr. Karim, or from DTI, or indeed whether it wouldn't be available from STAT South Africa, for example. So we may, with our researcher, just want to directly explore some of these possibilities to see where we would get that data from. But I also think that as we put these two... Honourable Kwabasa, I'm constantly reminded that you may have had a question.
Yes,
because the committee secretary keeps poking me. Thank you.
No, Chairperson, I'm mindful that you might want to close, but let me raise the question. There might be other difficulties. Just what has been the rationale behind our extensive and very rapid liberalization of trade then? And secondly, what have we achieved as a country, if anything at all, out of it? On your first bullet, you're talking about exports having increased since 1994, but in the same paragraph you're saying the basket of export goods has remained unchanged. It's not clear to me what that means. It does sound like contradicting the earlier point that you're making. On your trade strategy, the second point, you're mentioning SACU, SADC, EAC, and COMESA, and so on. I'm not so sure whether you know the economic community of the West African states is deliberately excluded, and for what reason, if you could explain that too. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, that came up earlier this morning, but let's address it to Mr. Karim as well.
I think the member also put those questions. I think the rationale behind the liberalization episode from 1994 was essentially that South Africa had been the assessment had been that South Africa's manufacturing was a high cost manufacturing center, increasingly uncompetitive, highly protected, as a result of years of import substitution policies in the 70s and 80s, and that was overlaid by 3 years of sanction under apartheid. And I think there was an assessment that was made in the late 80s and early 90s that in order to ensure that South Africa became increasingly competitive and integrated into the global economy, there was a need for liberalization. Now, I think the big question that one would need to confront is whether or not the liberalization episode was too quick. We committed to reduce tariffs in terms of the commitments we took in the WTO, in the Uruguay round, as a developed country, which meant that our tariff liberalization phase down was much more rapid and extensive than other developing countries. So there's that dimension to it, whether or not the commitments we took in the WTO were too rapid. Now, those are legally binding commitments that we took in 1994. But the rationale for liberalization was that we wanted to improve the competitiveness of the South African manufacturing, but it also implied that we needed to have a clear industrial strategy. And I think in a sense, we haven't got the alignment right. It's easier to liberalize, easier to reduce your tariffs, it's more difficult to put in place support programs that would support your broad industrialization or your industrialization approach. And I think what we're seeing is what we've been seeing over the last few years is the result of that. And I think there are concerns about deindustrialization, loss of jobs, in certain sectors, in particular that have important employment dimensions, etc. But I think what it does mean is that we need to be much more careful. I think the lesson that comes out of it is that one needs to be much more careful about further tariff reform in future. The point about the increase in our trade, I think aside from the last year where we, there may be a couple of years where our trade volumes did not increase and trade values did not increase, our exports did not increase. Every other year we've seen increases in South African exports to the world. So the total value of exports has continued to grow. The point that we're trying to make is if you look at the content of that, it is still the top 10 or 25 product lines, depending on the classification that you use, remain commodities. It's primary product. It's coal, it's iron, it's gold, it's diamonds, etc., etc. So it's mainly minerals. We're not producing, we're not selling enough manufactured products. And that's the essential point that we've been trying to make. On the trade strategy, ECOWAS is a regional grouping of the West African countries. SACU and SADC is Southern Africa, and we're members of that. The new initiative that emerged 2 years ago was a proposal, because some of the members of SADC are also members of COMESA and also members of the East African community. Those are the countries that in particular pushed for some type of trilateral, so that they would not have to choose between one regional grouping or the other. I think from South Africa's point of view, it's an important initiative because, as we indicated, South Africa's trade in Africa is important for our industrial development. And if we were to get preferential access into a larger market in Africa, that should have benefits for the domestic economy. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Karim. Members, I'm sorry we've gone on just into your lunchtime, but perhaps you will be able to get some quickly. Thank you very much. Just refreshing your memories about tomorrow. And that is Thursday. You will recall that we spoke about starting at 1:30. So I hope, Honourable Kotsi, you were going to just confirm whether you'd be here, and I just see you trying to escape.
I can only be here.
All right. Thank you. Right.
and I'm sure the rest of us then will all be here. I know that there are one or two members, I know Honourable Mabasa, that you raised an issue with me, so they're on the line in respect of another committee. But let us all be here, the rest of us. And we are continuing then with, is it the public hearings on the IPAP, the recall? Right, thank you very much. So, over to you, and we'll see you tomorrow in this venue. Thank you.